Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop renewal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! It's Friday. It's a minute past the hour, the end of a week of conversation radio that was more normal than not, which makes it kind of unusual given the amount of time that I've been out of the chair lately. But it's wonderful to have a full week under my belt and to be facing 3 hours of week-ending conversation. Looking forward to it. Of course, the weekend schedule is always there for you on the horn. We've got the Rick Smith Show. Great pro-labor guy, smart guy, good show. Coming to you Saturday afternoon about 5:15 p.m. Eastern Time. Followed by Rick's Place with horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner. And then Night Sounds with Billy Shears at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. That'll roll through pretty much in rotation, with the exception of the addition of Rick Smith's second show on Sunday afternoon. And then, of course, live conversation radio comes your way 9 p.m. Eastern Time Sunday evening with the renewed and refreshed John Fox and all Foxed Up, 9 p.m. Sunday evening. It'll be a good weekend. But for me, I have to shut up in about 3 hours and just kind of spend the rest of the weekend walking around on, you know. So I'm hoping we got 3 hours of good conversation in front of us. This is one of those thought-inducing days. We're having a birthday around here. Our youngest had her birthday today, and she is feeling all grown up. Almost a teenager. And I don't know if you're like me, but my memory works funny. My reality works funny. My world works funny. And for the life of me, and I've mentioned this before, all through the lives of my children, I can never imagine them any other way than the way they are in the present. I have to work really hard to look back what is a significant span of years now to the day I held our youngest in my arms for the first time and wept at the sheer beauty of her. And of course, there are milestones in raising children. Their mother, their grandfather, and I all wept like babies the first day they went off to school. The first day they give you that kiss, turn their back on you, and march resolutely out to the bus is not just a little bit profound. We don't have much of a bus ride around here. It's about a mile down to the elementary school and the middle school. Slightly longer ride to the high school, largely because of the roads that have to be traversed. We're on the front end of a really big country road loop. But it's not much of a bus ride. And it's largely uneventful. With that in mind, I draw your attention to Pikeville, Kentucky. Pikeville, Kentucky. Yesterday. It was the beginning of the school day. A little bit wet. Not frozen or sleety or anything. But a little bit wet. A bus driver with his charges in the bus, being kids, noisy, vibrant, loud, raucous. On his way to the local school there in Pikeville, when suddenly coming at him in the opposite direction, roared a monster coal truck. Monster coal trucks are the bane of the coal fields of West Virginia and the coal fields of Eastern Kentucky. This is Kentucky. A monster coal truck roared at them in the opposite direction, and coal truck drivers act like they own the roads. It is your job to get out of the way of them. You know, at the beginning of the week, I mentioned that I had driven down to Huntington for a mountain removal hearing. See, I'm still learning, too. A mountain removal hearing. It was brief, and I turned around and came back. But on the way down there, I got myself a first-class scare. Now, I drive an old beat-up pickup truck, and it can pretty much hold its own. It's a three-quarter ton affair. It can hold its own on the road. But nothing on the road is a match for an overloaded coal truck, and they are all overloaded. They all cheat. Because the poor truck drivers are paid by the ton. They don't even have enough sense to demand to be paid by the hour. They're paid by the ton. So the more they haul, the more they're paid. The faster they go, the more they can haul, the more runs they can make, and the more they can be paid. And down past Alloy, just west of Alloy, West Virginia, and before you get to Boomer, quaint little names we have around here, aren't they? The overweight monster coal truck came howling at me. And I braced for to be passed. When a coal truck is coming at you, you make no assumptions, and you ready yourself to take evasive action. Because these guys can't stop. It's hard enough to stop one of those trucks empty. Imagine it with the inertial force of, 120,000 pounds behind it. And lo and behold, the coal truck passed me. He wasn't tarped. He didn't have a tarp on top of his great big load of West Virginia's wealth that he was taking to points unknown. There was no tarp. And as he passed, something flew off that coal truck and bang! Into the upper right front of the kind of where the corner of where the windshield and the roof meet. That will scare you real good. But nothing really happened, except that I was suddenly much more alert than I had been. In Pikeville, Kentucky, however, a different story. Mommies and daddies in the area have put their precious ones on the school bus, sending them for their education. It's a little bit wet, but not snowy or icy, as I said. And at them comes a monster coal truck. And as the old saying goes, he's demanding his half the road. The problem is that for the monster coal truck driver, his half the road happened to be the middle half. And the bus driver got all the way off the road, over the shoulder, past the berm, and drove in the ditch. It took him 175 yards to stop as the bus was dragged along the rock wall next to which the road runs. It happened about 8 a.m. 20 children had to be taken to Pikeville Medical Center. The journalism involved, or what passes for it, involved with this story is absolutely stunning. In the first run of the story, as covered by WSAZ Television, Huntington, Charleston, there was no mention whatsoever of the monster coal truck. None at all. 60 children in the bus, 20 of them injured. The faux journalist who wrote the story noted all the injuries were minor. These were children from East Ridge High School and Feds Creek Elementary. All the injuries were minor. The faux journalist in question writes, only three ambulances were called to the scene. Only three. Only three ambulances. That story was posted, and it took a chunk of the day to get an update in. At 3 p.m. yesterday, the story was updated with these words. Police say the bus was traveling on Kentucky 1499 at around 8 a.m. when the driver moved the bus to the far right of the road to make way for an oncoming coal truck. Police say wet weather conditions could have contributed to the crash. Really? Wet weather conditions? Police didn't say a monster coal truck forcing the bus driver off the shoulder, over the berm, and into the ditch contributed to the crash? Really, WSAZ? Really? And it was absolutely, as usual with these stories, it's fascinating to watch what happens. One kid claims that she was on the bus. You all have this story completely wrong. I was on the bus when this happened. And I was a student that was taken to the hospital in an ambulance on a stretcher in a neck brace because my back and neck was hurting me tremendously. There was no coal trucks around, and it weren't even 7:30. Here's the story. A boy was pounding on the side of the bus and screaming, and the bus driver told him to be quiet, and he looked back at him, and the next thing I know, we were smashing into a cliff and bouncing all over the place and ended up in a ditch. No coal truck. But what's fascinating is to read the rest of the comments where people start trying to blame the bus driver and ignore the coal truck. It's amazing what dementia that gets imposed in coal country. When coal is poisoning and killing and threatening and maiming people, most people in this region try to look away to avoid noting that the only thing that brings us money, because, you know, coal keeps lights on, the only that there was a hand in it. You see, there is something so, and yes, there are other stories, and we will get to them, and they're good stories. But we had a birthday today, and I think about our youngins, and I think about the fact that even though it's a fairly innocuous bus trip for our kids, they never get on the bus that Agnes and I don't worry. She stands in the doorway and watches until they were all the way on the bus, and until the bus begins to move and she sees our children seated, she will not turn from the door. and she stands in the doorway as the bus arrives and will not move until our children are back in the bosom of our family. What a horror it must be to have to put your children on a school bus knowing that they're going to traverse roads that they have to share with King Cole. What a worry, what a fear, what a horror. So I just wanted to share that with you. We live in a dangerous world. We live in a world where no matter how hard you try as a parent, you cannot be certain that your child will not, or grandchild, will not be tempted with something God-awful somewhere along the way. And add into the mix something that shouldn't even be a threat. If I lived somewhere that the coal trucks shared the buses had to share the road with the coal trucks, I don't think I'd get any rest. My daughter, her husband, and their little children are traveling right now, and I suddenly understand my father and my mother, who, when I would look at them going back and forth to college, I'd say, it'll be all right. I'm a good driver. And they'd look at me and say, we understand, but everybody else isn't one. And we will worry until you get to your appointed destination and let us know that you are there safely. I really understand now. So just some food for thought as we move into the evening. Other things to hit this evening. Our blogger, Texas Betsy, she of the wonderful Relaxed Politics blog, let me know today that Harry Reid doesn't like us anymore. So hopefully there will be some time for that. What else? Some Godzilla from Wasilla news. She is apparently quite selective about those with whom she prays. Yes. Michelle Bachmann is still crazier than a sprayed roach, like you didn't know. Representative Daryl Issa is a right-winger from Southern California, from the San Diego area, is standing up for womanhood. Mm-hmm. Joe the Not a Joe, Not a Plumber is going on the road. Even in Texas, John Ashcroft can't get a complete welcome. And, of course, Glenn Beck. Well, Glenn Beck's just Glenn Beck, and he's there for our entertainment. But let's start this front porch edition of this Friday evening with the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Brother Bob.
Brother Luke, how are you?
Well, you have to understand, it was that bus driver's fault for not driving over the cliff so he'd be out of the way of a coal truck.
Well, ain't that the truth?
I mean, I'm sure by the Monday that the story will be that the coal truck driver stopped heroically to check on the children.
Yes, yes, because he carries a stretcher with him.
I know. Yeah. All right, let's see. Got a few things here tonight. Well, I saw the thing tonight. One of the other ones I saw was L. Brent Bozo raised his head up again. He was had a story on CNN. They were talking about the fact that about Russia's numbers have gone up tremendously in February. And I was sitting there just looking at my calendar going, it's still March 27th. Now, you were in radio, so in the commercial radio. So
yeah.
As I remember, the book comes out like every 3 months, doesn't it, on numbers?
Some major markets are constantly sampled, but it's not turned around in real time. Not always, no.
What I was understood was it came out quarterly, generally, the big books, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And thing of it is, as I understand it, they quit at the end of the year, so the first book of this year shouldn't come out till next week. So I'm just wondering what the hell's making up his numbers for us.
Well, you know, what do you want from a guy who hosts a media awards dinner, invites not a Joe, not a plumber, who walks out on the stage and says, "Oh, wow, I'm horny."
I'm surprised. I guess most of the main news people are just afraid of how the heck can we put this? So we'll have.
But L. Brent Bozo, I don't. That's another. There's a case of a guy having relevancy that is not earned.
I know. Well, let's see. I saw today a bit of sad news. Somebody we used to watch in our younger days. I saw the Mr. Irving R. Levine passed away.
Did he really?
Yes. Like 86, I believe they said. He was one of the last of the old newsmen still left. He was one of the men that used to wear ties. He was essentially an economics reporter. At, you know, for the last few years, you know, I mean, that's what he did, was mostly business reporting.
Mm-hmm.
So, saw that. Oh, the talk about media, the story I saw the other day blew my mind. You see the story about the brown recluse spider story?
No. How did I possibly miss a brown recluse story?
This was a story where they said, man had been bitten by a brown recluse. They took him to the hospital, and amazingly enough, now he can walk. He was a paraplegic.
Oh, yeah. That one. Okay, yeah.
Well, apparently the boys ran to the teleprompter too fast, because the story I saw it somewhere the other day was, well, apparently this happened like 6 months ago or, you know, a few months ago, and what happened was the guy was a paraplegic and he got bitten by a brown recluse spider. That's true. They took him to the hospital and they were treating him. While they were treating him, the nurse noticed he was having leg spasms. Turns out he'd been injured in a fall, and she saw he was actually having some movement, so got him into therapy, and it was like 3 or 4 months later he's able to walk again. But when you read the story the way they first had it, you'd believe that a brown recluse bit a man and he was able to walk all of a sudden.
Well, that was the idea that was put across, but no?
No.
No, no.
I mean, it was a good story. I'm glad the gentleman got to walk again.
Well, I mean, there are those neat stories out there about people with terrible, terrible, like, rheumatoid arthritis in their knuckles, and they'll get honeybee stings. And that alleviates. I read about that somewhere, but anyway.
Yeah, that's what it is.
But no, so this was it. What just like that?
It ended up being a good story, but not as good as they wanted it to be.
Didn't quite last long enough to get Robert De Niro and Robin Williams signed up to play the roles, huh?
Afraid not. Well, I saw over at Democratic Underground that UPS now says they're going to quit sponsoring Mr. Bill O'Reilly Show.
Yes, they are, and it would all. I'm sure that somewhere in O'Reilly land, there's a high-level status conference going on right now as to whether or not to let the idiot mention it.
Oh, he will. I'm sure he'll. It's part of a conspiracy against him.
Oh, yeah, by that far right-wing smear machine that's comprised of insects.
Yeah.
Yeah, think progress.
Oh, either that or, what's his main one? Center of the universe, was it the Daily Cause?
Yes, it was.
It all leads back to George Soros, no matter how it goes.
Right, but yeah, Daily Coast was just like Hitler, wasn't that it?
Yeah, that was it. Oh, I saw the other one. Did you see the one last night the NBC was carrying? I didn't see the major one. I wanted to touch it. The MSNBC was talking about it. But apparently they had, the GOP had this thing to unveil their budget yesterday and had old Leatherface there. And they put out this, like, 19-page budget, except there's no numbers in it.
Then, now, you and I, we live in reality world. Under that set of circumstances, it's really not a budget, now is it?
Well, I had one of the guys on last night was talking at Oberman's show. It said they got there, said everybody had one of them there at their chair, and said it was like 19 pages. You know, had a nice blue. He had it with him, had a nice blue. All this, but they got looking through it, you know, while they're waiting for it to start. And there's only one little set of numbers where one of the main suggestions they have is they want to bring down that prime rate, the rate on the wealthiest from 36 to 25. But other than that, there's no numbers anywhere in the thing. It's a whole bunch of talking points.
Well, you know, but I'm tired of this. I'm tired of this incrementalism, Luke. I say we just stop taxing the rich. Those poor, and I recognize the irony in using it, little rich people, have had enough.
Well, if you want to see how bad Lepore are even off, if you saw the thing today, we're on most of that. Aaron Spelling's wife's putting that new house up for sale. That monstrosity that he built before he died.
Yes.
You know, it's like the biggest, probably the biggest house in America.
Yeah, you can see it from space, that kind of thing.
Probably a race of which one's bigger, it or built more mansions. You know. And it's like $150 million.
With 14 bathtubs.
Yeah.
I know.
You know how they're just suffering. Oh, but I did see the thing that Overman was talking about last night. He said, and I didn't realize, he said, you know, that Murdoch has lost 57% of his wealth.
Well, you know, that's along the same lines as what we saw about Warren Buffett, was it, the other day, that he's down to his last $40
billion? But, you know, I mean, what was it? Bella was on the thing talking about the fact that GE was going out of business. You know, everybody's, you know, it's like this thing where they're talking about the donations being down. It's like, well, shoot, everybody's tired right now. I'm sorry. I mean, if somebody said their numbers were going up, I'd be wondering where they're getting the money.
Bernie Madoff.
Well, I tell you what, it's Friday, bud, and I'm going to get on out of here and head on to the house. So you have a good evening.
All right, and you have a good weekend.
Enjoy while you can.
Going to try. Talk to you all soon, right. Luke. Bye now.
Bye.
In East Tennessee, our buddy Luke. Luke's got a hound dog's nose for keeping up with the comings and goings of the right-wing media madness. And with madness operating as our meme, let's try, golly Moses, let's try National Rifle Association on for size from the You Can't Make This Up department. I mentioned Glenn Beck earlier. Well, he's mad on so many different levels that it's almost difficult to know where to start. But he is mad. Remember, I'm sorry, that's a Monty Python riff. It's not a thing of stuttering. But Glenn Beck is crazy, and he likes to have crazy people on with him. Now, you know the story from yesterday that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made some rather pointed remarks about the so-called war on drugs and the absolute social and civic nightmare that has created in Mexico. One of the things that she said is that we can't seem to keep American guns from getting into the hands of Mexican drug cartels, which is true. I mean, we know here in West Virginia, because we give out guns in gumball machines, see. I mean, it's quite easy to get a gun. We know that people come here, buy firearms, and take them back to places like Detroit. It is almost like some sort of little merchant freeway going on. They bring us drugs, and in return for drugs, they take home guns. Well, the same thing happens on an even grander scale on the border. And it's American guns that are going to Mexican drug cartels. Names like Winchester, and Remington, and Sturm, Ruger, and all manner of firearms that come across the border. You know, we get Mexican undocumented immigrants across the border into the United States, and we reciprocate by sending, by having a border like a sieve that lets firearms through without a lot of problem. So that brings us to Glenn Beck. Crazy, crazy Glenn Beck, who hosted National Republican Rifle Association president, Wayne LaPierre. He only rose to the leadership of National Republican Rifle Association because Charlton Heston finally shuffled off this mortal coil. But Wayne LaPierre wanted to be heard on the issue of American guns in Mexico. This is one of those gotta hear it to believe it kind of moments. Okay, just any time. Oh, God, this isn't going to be one of those Fridays I spend in Bufferville, is it? Please, please, please.
Frenchman I like is Wayne LaPierre. He's...
I don't think I can stand it. We'll wait for we'll wait forever and a day for this thing to load. But, you know, when you hear Glenn Beck say, the only Frenchman I like is Wayne LaPierre, it's just not going to end well. But at any rate, Wayne LaPierre showed up on Glenn Beck's program to declare that the violence in Mexico's drug war, quote, not kidding, is not from American guns. Guns don't kill people. Mexican drug lords with guns kill people. LaPierre even went so far, I really wish this would load.
He's with us now from the NRA, the National Rifle Association, because the Second Amendment is under fire. When you go to, have you ever gone to like...
Wait, the Second Amendment's under fire? Didn't we just tell everybody in Washington, D.C. to lock and load? Sorry.
Get-togethers with all your French relatives, Wayne. To those LaPierre
pictures. I can tell you, I wish I could find him, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, they'd be like, I don't know what you're doing with this gun thing, mister.
Now, you'd have to see the graphic. Constitution under attack. Where was that graphic for the last 8 years? I'm just asking. But this is stunning to behold, because Wayne LaPierre actually says the Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is fudging its own numbers for gun traces at the connivance of the United States State Department, Mexican government officials, and, you know, it really wouldn't be complete without it, the media. I wish I could make this stuff up. 90% of the guns found in Mexico's drug violence are American guns. But Wayne LaPierre can't stand to live in that reality, so he just makes up wild-eyed, crazy stuff.
Wayne, spit on you.
Yeah, George Carlin used to make a lot of fun of the name.
Really? Okay, so Wayne, the Second Amendment is under fire in a couple of things.
Oh, screw it. Never mind. But you get the idea. And we got more crazy Glenn Beck. It's Friday. We might as well end on a giggle. Really, I think he's got hinges on his skull like some sort of Hannibal Lecter story, and every morning they just open it up and pour in 5 quarts of 10W crazy. But he's making a fortune doing it. Good work if you can get it. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yeah, it's good work, all right, Brother Bob.
Yes, it is, Brother Albert.
He is absolutely, he's absurd. Hey, he converted to Mormonism, that's all you can say. He wasn't like raised to believe in the golden tablets of Malachi and the corn cob fields. I mean,
he was a full grown adult when he decided that all the Indians were secret Jews.
Yeah, and we'll find that lost tribe. It's promised, and Jesus, you know, and he is just.
And what was that? The great was that the great war between the morons and the knee-highs, or I forget. You can't tell them without a without some seeing stones and a top hat. You can't tell no.
Yeah, there's only so far I can dive into things like that, you know, before you just... Sometimes you can have too much information, and one of those things that, like, oh, you guys do baptisms for all the people that died and that weren't Mormon, and it is a little strange. Yeah, they build an impressive building, though, I'll tell you that.
They do, and that remake of... that remake of Seven Brides for One Brother from Mormon Studios, great piece of filmmaking.
Oh, brother.
Wow, I got nothing. What? I stole that one from Eugene Finnerman, by the way, but it was too precious not to use, and I get an oh, brother. It's Friday, Albert. Lighten up.
I know. Well, they just don't stop and export all over the place, and you know, and just like every time we talk about it, you know, they never want to address the actual issues. It's not even the guns; it's the money. It's the money. You can't stop if you can't stop the drugs, and you can't stop the guns. What makes you think you're going to stop the money? You can't stop it. You just can't. The only way to stop it is to stop boosting their products. You know, it's like. I don't see cigarettes advertised on primetime TV anymore. Yet, you know, they still make a buck, don't they?
Yep, a few.
Yeah, you know, so it's like, you know, when you got these commercials out there and everything else, you know, they're actually advertising for the stuff, and you know, the next thing you know, what do we got? We got a market, and the market's there anyway, and you know, just to kind of.
Well, how is it? Let me ask you then, Albert. How is it we're so stupid about the war on drugs, whereas we actually figured stuff out with the war on booze? Prohibition came along in 1919, and by 1933 it was gone?
Exactly. We learned the prohibition bit pretty quick, and I don't understand why we think we can continue it. It doesn't work. It simply does not work, and that's why with what Obama said, and I just kind of want to, you know, I hope he is a smarter than... President, not sure, we should say. I hope he's a lot smarter than we kind of give him credit for. And maybe he just doesn't, you know, maybe it was the way it was phrased. I mean, you know, it would be really for him to dismiss a question that was literally number one, number two, or number three on so many, on a wide, vast variety of subjects because, you know, it is so multifaceted. You know, so for him to brush it off like that the way he did, it's pretty stupid, you know, like, let's just look at numbers, you know, let's look at numbers in terms of people. It's estimated that 60 million people per year consume cannabis at one time or another. 15 million people admit to government, people that call them on the, you know, on the phone, government, you know.
Hello, this is the government, are you high?
Exactly. Have you smoked marijuana in the last 30 days? 15% say, 15 million say yes. Now, out of that 15 million and the totality of 60 million, how many of those people do you think voted for John McCain?
Only the ones that were smoking the really bad brown Mexican weed. Or maybe some paraquat.
Yeah. Those hillbillies you were talking about drinking beer. I can drink beer all night.
Yeah.
You know, this is why I can see Obama saying, you know, no, I don't think it will fix the economy, just because you wouldn't want to say, you know, a president goes into drug dealing. I mean, the headlines would just be atrocious on that. So
really, they would.
Yeah. And
Obama to America, catch a fire.
You know, and if you got, I mean, you listen to what the crazies are saying. I mean, they're making stuff up right now, but if he said, yeah, I think it could fix the, Bob, you heard the press conference, right? You watched it, or maybe you read the transcript.
Yeah.
And you saw where Major Jenkins, whatever his name is, he sits there and asks the president if he believes in a one-world currency. And what was the president's answer? Right? It was a two-letter word, says no.
Yeah.
What does Sean Hannity go on the next night and say that the president said about one world currency? Yeah, we'll take a look at it. They create things. They fabricate things. They're the weavers of the emperor's new clothing. I mean, that's all they have. They just have to try to create this, the
from
reality.
Yeah, yeah, from alternative budgets with no numbers in them, as Luke noted, to transposing no into, I think we need to have a look at it.
Yeah.
I think you're right, Albert. This goes beyond mere dishonesty. This is not a boating accident. This is not just a screw up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this isn't accidentally getting in a gasoline fight in the parking lot in Zoolander because you were transported by Wake Me Up Before You Go Go.
Yeah.
this is full on, full court press mendacity with a side order of recognizing that their audience does not have the mental acuity to tell the difference between the truth and a lie, or between facts and a lie. There we go, facts. Exactly. I like facts better.
Facts. Oh, exactly. I mean, you know, that's why, in a sense, you know, just as the guns, you know, would be, you know, the whole gun issue, which is just a myth, you know, for most of what they're saying, gun seizures, and all this other stuff, none of that stuff's probably going to happen. You can't. You're going to put the genie in a bottle, and you can't. You're not going to herd cats. You're just not going to do certain things, and you don't want to give right-wingers any real ammunition. You know, let them think they're on fire. It's just their gums, you know. But, you know, if we start giving them real ammunition, like, oh, yeah, marijuana will save the economy, which it will. I mean, it certainly will. It's too vast of just a new income boost in a resource area and all that other stuff. So, but he can't go, oh yeah. You know, he can't, I mean, one world currency. That is like, that's the prime rib of, right wing frothiness. I mean, one world government. Oh no.
Oh yeah, they get Santorum all over themselves.
Oh, for real. It's ridiculous. And you know, in reality, for the most part, I mean, Clinton said something about it, but it was Bushy that said all that stuff about it. It was his Poppy, and then it was Reagan, and it was like all these guys, you know, they always talk about that, and it's like, you know, I don't know what the hell they're trying to say, but, you know, at the same time, you know, that's red meat for these people, and you kind of can't, I don't know, you got to be a little bit more of a jujitsu artist, I think. And I think Obama's got some decent jujitsu.
Well, I'll tell you one thing he did with that flippant little what did we call it, too cute by half remark.
Yeah.
He did a world of good for Normal. They average about $900 a day in donations, and in the last 24 hours, it's zipping past $3,500.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be, and it's got to be a groundswell. Of, you know, hey, listen, buddy, you see those extra million votes? Well, those people that voted for you were real high. And, you know, it's not, you know, it's just, it, think about it. I mean, think about it. Think about how, I mean, you just think of the numbers. The people that voted for him are not, you know, the people that voted for McCain are not smoking the pot. They're just not.
No. You know? The guy, let's expand on that. The guys that came up with the Iraq War weren't high.
No.
The guy who was handed a brochure titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. was sober when he ignored it. You know, I remember when the late, great George Carlin, peace be upon him, remarked on a gentler day when people on airplanes would go into the lavatory to catch a buzz.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you come out and you got that telltale suction ring where you've been holding the doobie down by the suction of the sink, and the ring's on your, I hope they don't see the ring. And he said that, you know, you get in there, you get a couple of hits in you, and then you notice the old gray bubbles on the soap that the old man left, and the next thing you're into detail and you're doing the walls. Frankly, if somebody had been a little bit toasted, they might have gotten into the detail of Bin Laden determined to strike inside U.S. Now, the downside of that is that they might have forgotten to tell anybody about it.
Well, I don't know about that, buddy. I don't know about that. Come on now. You know, you would have sat there and said, wait a minute, who wants to strike us? Why? Why would they want to strike us? And we might have actually come up with a different solution. We might have said, wait a minute. Oh, yeah, we do have guys there, huh? Yeah, you know what we should start doing now? You know what? Sweet. If we were to start building an alternative energy structure in this country at that time, because we would have seen that one of the reasons that we're in the Middle East and causing all this problem is for this oil.
And the Secretary of State looks at you and goes, dude.
Good idea. You know, let's start getting off it now. You know, all right, you know, they might get us. They still might attack our interests and stuff, but we will be in a better position. Let's reposition ourselves to be, you know, less vulnerable to the crazy people. I mean, that's what I would have said if that was me getting that thing. I would have said, wait a minute, well, why does he hate us? Oh, okay, because we're over in his holy land. Why are we there for oil? Okay. What can we do here? Let's put some funding into this. I mean, heck, how much money have we spent on Iraq? How much money?
Oh God! Well, we don't know because it was all off the books, but we got an idea.
We could have built a spaceship. We could have built the Battlestar Galactica for the price of this crap.
I know.
And I mean,
whole fleet of Millennium Falcons.
Seriously.
Maybe with even functioning hyperdrives.
Exactly, and R2-D2, the whole nine yards. I mean, this is serious. I mean, we waste so much of our resources, and I just hope it's not too late in terms of how much energy we actually have left. You know, if we can finally build this infrastructure that's going to be required. I mean, did you see in the news? It's Science Friday here on the Horn. Did you see what this Navy chemist actually doing, reduplicating? And you're going to hear it again. Here it is again. Cold fusion.
No, it's back?
Yeah, go look. It was on New Scientist. They're showing that there is a nuclear reaction going on at some level with the deuterium, heavy water, and all that other stuff. And they put this current into it. And, you know, heck, you know, if it's showing promise at that level, if we could do something like that, I'll tell you what, we can go a long way to healing a lot of wounds. It's like if you ever get a burn or you have a, there's a stuff out there called emu oil.
Oh, yeah.
That stuff works. It works. It heals wounds really, really good. You'll sit there.
And remind me, what is the, and if you don't know, I'm sure somebody in the chat room does, what is the waste product that is the end result of fusion? Not fission, fusion.
What would we get? It'd probably be just more useful materials, wouldn't it? Because it's coming together, it's forming what? I don't even know. It's forming hydrogen or helium-3 or one of those things, isn't it? So I'm sure it's, you know, it's going to be, I know whatever is formed is pretty much benign, maybe water, maybe something like it's.
That's what I was, water? Water? We could use some clean water.
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell you what, if we had an energy source, there's a lot of things we could do. We could clean our water. You know, because if you had an energy source where it didn't run out, you could pump all that water out of those coal slurry pits, okay, that are hanging above schools. You could run these things through a plasma, basically a big plasma furnace. Now, this plasma furnace will separate because plasma and electrical fields operate, and they will separate. First off, the temperature is so high that no material can survive in it, nothing. It will literally rip everything down to its fundamental essential state of being, which is a plasma, and then once it gets into that plasma, it'll further separate it into its individual properties. Like if there's some gold in that coal dust, well, boop, it'll get the gold out of it. If there's mercury, boop, it'll take the mercury out of it, and it'll make it, and it'll purify these things. And it'll also detox it. I mean, you could handle radioactive waste like this, biomedical with anything, because nothing can survive. Downed cows with that bovine spongiform encephalitis, throw those guys in there. You could pump, you could have all this, you could do all this stuff because we have the energy available to do it. You know, you got the electricity, you're good to go. If the electricity is not producing massive amounts of pollution and coal ash and all that other stuff, you're good to go. If you could sit there and, you know, I mean, even if we just had a way to separate the, you know, those heavy toxic metals so we could then again further isolate them by putting them in some resin or some sort of epoxy and maybe putting them back in the coal mines or something along those. I don't know. I don't know what we could do with them, but we can't keep them in pits. We can't sit there and pollute our groundwater with it. I do know that, you know. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we can do if we can energy, I wouldn't say free, but we just get some energy that, you know, can certainly supply us with what we need it for, you know, to kind of fix our mess. You know, we've made a big mess of this planet, and people like Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity, they just want to see it continue to burn. You know, it's like...
Right. I mean, it's all... George Bush did not have the creativity to come up with that idea of, what will history say about me? I don't know. I'll be dead. That's, you know, that whole grasshopper versus the ant, and they're the grasshoppers, you know, consume thy storehouse of well-being now, for tomorrow we'll be dead. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. You know, that's another one of those, you know, that comes from the Bible, but it is not put in the mouth of a smart person.
Yeah.
But that's where they are. They anything that threatens what they perceive to be their comfort level, whether it is whether it is Sean Hannity's ability to, I don't know, eat little kid kidney pie every night for dinner, or some mountain remover's wife's ability to have an in-home tanning bed, there's a whole segment of society whose priorities are truly ass backwards. And who have completely lost sight of the delineating mark between want and need. Now, that's not to say that that has not been enforced along the way by our consumerist religion.
Mm-hmm.
We are constantly bombarded to make us lose sight of the difference between want and need. As in, I need a new Cadillac Escalade. No, you want one. It's like the dichotomy between know and believe. I ran across that earlier today. A woman on a blog talking about how she believed this and believed that. And you know what that word does to me. I mean, it's like a dose of salts. Honest to God, it just goes right through me. And makes me crazy. Because for me, anybody who's trying to carry on a debate, a point and counterpoint, if you will, the minute they say, I believe, I know for a fact, whether they are consciously or unconsciously, they are intellectually dishonest because they're hiding behind that word.
Yes.
Because we've created a culture in which as long as you say you believe it, whether it's Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, Tinkerbell, or clean coal, or family, or Republican family values. Whether it's any of those, the minute you say I believe, you know that the other side is involved in justifying something that is absolutely divorced from reality.
Exactly. Yeah, because you know, I mean, right after they say I believe, it's going to be the Lord cometh, and you know, God, because. Wants it like that, and, you know.
Or, you know, maybe it's just, I believe, for every drop of rain that falls, a flower blooms. We'd be up to our asses in flowers if that was true. I mean, you couldn't get around for all the damn roses and tulips and peonies and irises and lilies. Now, every drop of rain, really? You know, it's Bugs Bunny running away. Run for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in Martians. We'd be up to our armpits in flowers. We'd hate flowers. But, you know, as long as you believe, because believing is a protected class.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's sad. It's sad that somebody can, yeah, well, look, you know, it's all about faith, having faith. And you have faith, and then you can, you know, I believe, well, back to where we started. I believe we could win the war on drugs. Really? How are we going to win the war on drugs?
No, I just said I believe it. I didn't say I knew how. I believe it.
Well, see, I know how. I believe I know how to do it. How?
How can you do it?
No, I only said I believe
I would love an answer. I would love an answer. Oh, we got to start with the children. So, all right, so let's tell the children how scary it is. Okay, we'll tell them how scary it is. We'll tell them how dangerous it is. How smoking once will have long-lasting impact on your whole life and ruin it, and this is your brain, and this is your brain on drugs.
Dude, are you going to eat that? Yeah.
Well, exactly. That looks like a good. I could go for some eggs right now. No, you know, and then you sit there, and then eventually they're going to try it, and they're saying, nah, they're lying to you. Yeah, because that's the thing about kids. You know, kids do get together, and like they do for the most part for what they can decipher of how the world works. They kind of sometimes let their friends know how it goes. Like, oh no, man, they're bullcrapping you. Like, oh, that's a bunch of crap.
Let me share you a little bit of this believe in lunacy. This is just a fun one. Can't resist it. The story on the normal getting a fundraising boost out of President Not Sure's too cute by half remark. You go down a little way into the comments, and lo and behold, there's one of those 20%ers. God, I love them. There's not many of them anymore. You got to be really still and hide behind a rock, and use your loyal Bushy call.
Yeah, your Republic. You need your LaPierre scented urine cologne there.
You know, you kind of poke your little head out from behind the rock and say, repeal the death tax. Repeal the death tax. Privatize Social Security. Privatize. And boom, they'll pop right up. Just like whistling at a groundhog.
Yep. Oh.
So I see this one. In response to this story about nothing more than a fundraising boost happening for normal out of the marijuana transactional the question, you get this. Interesting. Whereas Bush was mocked as a drunk, although he hasn't had a drink in over 20 years, Obama is commended for being in AA. More double standards. Plus, Obama lacks the cocaine. Pot is for amateurs. What? What?
I don't know.
I need somebody to tell me that I'm really, really not on the same planet with that person.
Well,
or they're not on the same planet with me. They're not breathing the same. I don't know. Just sitting there honking on aerosolized horse tranquilizers, all I can figure for them.
It's ridiculous.
The walls, they're breathing.
It's ridiculous. Yeah, those are the kinds of women or people. I shouldn't say women, but those are the people that huff pledge and gasoline and or certainly abuse pharmaceutical drugs, and it's okay because their doctor gave it to them. But I hate drugs. While I'm on, Ritalin, everything else that, that's just, the hypocrisy never stops. You know, they talk about, is Obama in AA? I don't think Obama's in AA.
Obama
was drinking a beer at a basketball game, and that's okay with me.
But, and she buys a frozen cake, and she burns a frozen steak, and goes running to the shelter of her mother's little helper.
Yep.
Yeah, I think Keith Richard actually consulted on the lyric for that.
No, honestly, I mean, and that's that thing. He loves cocaine. Well,
Well, they all do. And they carry a razor in their shoe and listen to that jazz music.
Looking at them white women twice, white man's shadows. I mean, this is, And now it's turning, and honestly, this Mexican thing isn't about guns. It's not about guns. And, dealing with guns is not going to, solve the situation. I mean, granted, I think just, I'm not really for gun control, but I do think that people shouldn't be allowed to just go, how many guns will be this month, Ted? Oh, about 400.
Oh, I mean, you're driving over into Nuevo Laredo or whatever.
Yeah.
And how many guns do you have with you, sir? 16. Okay, move along. Nowhere near the limit.
Yeah, no, honestly, I mean, I can understand is that some people are collectors, Like, that's fine. It's an old, Billy the Kid had this gun. Oh, okay, this is this gun.
Gun culture being what it is in the United States, the fact of the matter is They are one of the most easily liquidatable, tangible assets you can have. I mean, I knew a guy, he had his federal firearms license, so he was able to buy wholesale. And he had disposable income, and when he had $10,000 laying around, he bought a shotgun. He didn't buy gold, he bought a shotgun. And 2 months later, he would turn it around for twice as much as he paid for it. I guess you've got to be in a culture that values them, but, you know, a good field gun. You know, the people who talk like this with their teeth clenched and have gold chains and chest hair and go to the hunting club and wear expensive clothing for killing grouse, they will pay that kind of money. And you can move that stuff like that. So, no, it's not just collector value. It's immediate appreciation value. And even if you were an Obama supporter who had his federal firearms license, if you're not loading up, to sell to the Looney Tunes?
Yeah.
You know, an actual Belgian-made Browning side-by-side double-barreled 12-gauge field gun? You know, with all the curlicue scroll work on the barrel and the hybridized hickory walnut stock and the gold-plated receiver and set, blah, yada, yada. I mean, the gun people sit around and talk about these things the way drunk fraternity boys talk about girls.
Seriously, they do. They do. I know a couple. I know a couple of guys, and they seem to just spend all their money on every kind. It's like, how many assault rifles do you need?
Yeah, see, that's so tacky. You know, Uzis and Tech Nines and all yuck. You know, where's the fat? No. I'm talking about that beautiful stuff. I mean, I used to, once upon a time, I came within that much of purchasing a Steyr, S-T-E-Y-R, I do believe, Steyr 30-06 hunting rifle. I think it's a Swiss manufacturer. I can't remember now. And it had the most beautiful, multicolored, almost rainbow-esque tiger stripe maple stock. Ah. Oh. And, you know, just perfectly blued steel.
Uh-huh.
And it was perfectly, it hefted perfectly in one's arms. And the weight was, the balance was stunning.
It
was a very good tool.
Yeah.
But then I started looking at it because the way I look at it, they're tools.
Yeah.
And if I marched my happy ass out into the brush and the briars, and the multiflora roses, in search of Bambi in the rut, and I dragged that firearm through the briars, and I got one thorn scratch across the stock, I'd come home and beat myself to death with that rifle for doing that magnificent piece of art that way. And I put my money back in my pocket. This was back when I, you know, walked around with folding money. When I did have a hunting rifle, I opted for synthetic stock, glass beaded, glass bedding for the barrel, and a stainless barrel. It was a most unelegant looking firearm, but it did its job, and you could march or, you know, you could damn near submerge the thing, and you'd be just fine. You know,
yep.
You know,
yeah.
you don't
need rubies and rhinestones on your 3/4-8 wrench. I mean,
right. Really? And you don't take the Mona Lisa to a finger painting class. You don't.
Yeah. Oh, you know, they know that they can use that to, you know, get support. You know, that's all that is. You know, they know they can. It's like membership drive week. You know, oh, see, they're coming. Oh, they want to. You know, hey, wait. Is that thing loaded up yet? I don't watch Glenn Beck. You know me. I don't watch TV. It hurts my blood too much. So, well, I do want to know what he said. What did he say? What's sensible? You know, reasoning behind all this.
Oh, crap. Goodness me! I may have gotten rid of it. I think I got rid. I did.
Oh, did you? Oh, okay.
Yeah, because that thing was
on transcript.
What he said was that the ATF, in conspiracy with the Department of State, were making up the numbers to make it appear like American guns were involved in the Mexican drug wars.
Okay. Well, what kind of guns do they have? That's the whole key. If we can find out what kind of guns they have just by looking
No, there were photos and all kinds of documentary evidence.
Yeah. Well, I know. I mean, if they're walking around with
Remingtons and Winchesters and...
They're probably, they probably more military, or they're drug dealers. They probably got the Tech Nines and that kind of stuff. All that stuff's made here, or
Colt. Yeah, the AR-15s. You know,
That's here.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, that's it. It's from Remington Arms, little known Lithuanian subsidiary.
That's the other one. You know, these gun people are pretty much like the Diamond Cartel. Fabrique Nationale, which is a Belgian company, you know, they get a U.S. military contract to make, the assault rifles of the Army and the heavy assault rifles of the Army and the Marine Corps with the SAW. You know, those are Belgian company guns, but, come on. You sit there and you think, just like the oil companies own the car companies and it's the same deal. Oppenheimer, they sell it to De Beers, and then De Beers sells it to the CGI group, and then the CGI, but it's all the same hands always constantly. They're just doing their little inflation card, three-card Monte game. Stock went up, that's all they're doing. I don't know how many stocks you have, Bob, but I'll tell you what, it's probably as many as I have, and that's about nothing. So it's one of these things that these people...
The last share of stock I bought was in some kid's junior achievement company.
I got stock in my local grocery stores. That's the stock I have. I have two shares. Damn right.
I'm
playing the market.
You live in Wisconsin and you don't have a share of the Packers?
No, I don't know.
Heretic?
No.
Unbeliever?
Absolutely. I don't believe in it. It's gladiator games. If I'm going to watch gladiator games, I want them to kill each other. Just on principle. Don't give me the fake stuff. Give me the real stuff. If we're going to watch gladiators and we're going to have our bread and circus, I want it to at least be fatal. No, that's just messing. I don't watch TV. I can't stand the commercials. I can't stand the mentality that it breeds. I know you're a big college fan, but it's like it breeds this mentality of...
Oh, I also recognize the hypocrisy that's involved.
I
was involved in an email exchange earlier today just talking about the basketball coaching merry-go-round that's going on in the Southeastern Conference right now. For guys, it's like watching a soap opera.
And
at the end of the day, David in Tennessee remarked that we may be fans, but we're also grown up enough to realize that we're watching something that is and these are David's words, a dirty, filthy business. Managed players, one-and-done kids that can't read, all the grease under the table, the AAU travel ball and swag for 14-year-olds. David in Tennessee says, more and more I care less and less for amateur athletics. We should mirror Europe. Kids go pro in cycling and soccer as early as 14. But tie it all to a university? Hell no. It's pro sports. Call it pro sports.
Yep.
Now, the reason I like college ball beyond, because I, frankly, this is Friday, so we can talk about this stuff. It has nothing to do with, the purism of the amateur, the horse feathers. It has to do with the rules of the game, frankly. I find the college football and basketball game to be a hell of a lot more competitive and a hell of a lot more enjoyable. Now, granted, the talent level is not that of the NBA or the NFL, but the offenses are different, the timing is different, and the way the game plays out is different. I mean, because during college football season on a Saturday or a Thursday or a Friday or a Sunday or Monday, they've just about spread it out all over. Yeah, money's money. But on a Saturday, I'll sit down and I'll watch Bodalusa A&T versus Our Lady of the Deaf and Blind, not knowing diddly about either one of them, but enjoying the hell out of the game. But again, I also recognize that there's a lot of fraud involved. And until you get down to something like NCAA Division III, where you've got things like the Williams College Purple Cows, where there are no scholarships, and if you play, it's because you walk on and you say, "Hey, coach, I want to play football." And he says, "Can you run, son?" "I reckon." "Can you hit things?" "You betcha." "Well, you're on the team." It's not quite like that, and the Williams fielded a decent team a few years ago. But it's for the game. And because there just aren't a hell of a lot of Division III players that go on to the NFL because they can't run a negative 3.840. You know, bang, I'm back. Can't do that.
I don't mind people playing a game. I don't mind that. I don't mind people watching a game. I just don't like it when it gets all glitzerly and glamour and cheap.
That's like through the regular season of college ball. It's a lot more enjoyable to watch. When you get down, God almighty, when you get down to bowl season, and particularly when you get down to the national championship game, jumping Jehoshaphat, you can't. The poor quarterback, and the Super Bowl's the same way. Quarterback can't run two plays before he's gonna stop. Then a little guy with the red flag walks out and holds it up. TV timeout. And it screws with the rhythm of the game, and it's no fun.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, they need their money, and they need to sit there, and everything has a price, and everything has a, you know, we got to put, and that's what makes me laugh, you know, in this right back into the, you know, war on drugs. You know, there's money involved on both ends of this. There's money involved, and, you know.
Oh, God, yeah, look at what's his name, Phelps. You know, that story I had a couple, Michael Phelps, the swimmer, you know, eight gold medals, did what no other human being's done before. Yep. But then he was seen hooting on a hookah, and it's all over, and Kellogg's dumps its contract with him, and they pull all their cornflakes with Michael Phelps with his gold medals on the box, pull all of those off the grocery stores across the food plain, and put them in a warehouse, and because they don't want the children seeing that dope head swimming champion. And then it winds up at the food. But then the dope head Kellogg's cornflake boxes wind up at the food bank in San Francisco. Well, they understand that kind of thing.
Cool, go get them. It's a collector's item. That's what makes me laugh. When last time the Olympics was it Rosengall or whatever that guy, that snowboarder. Remember, he won the gold medal, and then they're like, "Oh, you popped positive." What did the Olympic Committee call cannabis at that time? They called it a performance enhancing
drug.
So, what's the message here? And now, in a sense, I totally see that. If you were going to sit there, you know, like, what do they call it? The zone.
Yes.
Now, one of the properties of cannabinoids in your blood is it tends to give you, you pay attention to time like you did when you were a kid.
Yes.
And what it does is it slows down time. And you can still do everything you can, but it seems to slow down time so you can react faster. You can do things a little bit. I don't know if you've ever been on a mountain going down with a board strapped to your feet, but I'll tell you what, that's a trance-inducing thing, or anytime you go running or swimming or anything like that, you get into this trance where you're, you know, you're doing that stuff, and you're kind of helping out, and, you know, we've all, you know, I'm still waiting for them. I'm waiting. What I'm waiting for is I'm waiting for the negatives. I want to hear the negatives. What are the negatives here? If somebody can call in or let me know what the negatives are, I'd love to discuss it. I'd love to hear the reasoning. You know, I'd love to hear the rationale now for wasting all this money. I'd love to hear, you know, I mean, you know, sports, oh, that's one thing. And people can sit there and put money into it and it generates its own income. And all right, that's grand. But what's happening to this black hole here? You know, I want to also know, what's Obama doing about Iraq? What's he going to sit here and do about Afghanistan? These are things that we need to start really, literally, you know, we can't keep it. We can't have a $1 trillion deficit every year, Bob. I mean, we just, this is getting ridiculous now. We're already at, what, 14 trillion? Or what, is that what they say? 14 trillion, 10 trillion, 11 trillion? I don't even know anymore. It's so many trillion. You know, I'd like to.
Well, see, I've given up on that word, Albert. Trillion.
Yeah. Well, get ready for quadrillion.
I know. But you know, just since you mentioned the snowboarder guy, and I mentioned Phelps, you can't do this conversation without mentioning Vida Blue. Baseball fan at all?
Not really.
Okay. Vida Blue.
I'm sorry.
No. Just Vida Blue was a brilliant pitcher, pitched for the Oakland Athletics. And,
All right.
And went out one day, just one of his pitching days.
He pitched a perfect.
He won the Cy Young. He was a three-time World Series champion. Pitched a no-hitter.
On acid. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No doubt. Oh, that don't shock me at all. That does not shock me at all. It's one of the. I'll tell you a quick little story about an experience I had on LSD. I was the best, for a couple hours, I was the best dart player on earth. No, I wasn't imagining I was the best dart player on earth. I was the best dart player on earth. I would hit, they're like the real dartboard where you have the name, you know, the sportsman or whatever.
Yeah,
I would hit S-P-O-R-T. I mean, I would hit those. And I was hit, it was getting to the point, I was beating them so bad at cricket. I was like, 1-2, out. It was ridiculous. So they started throwing their darts and I started hitting them out of the air. That was awesome. That was my little claim to fame.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
I went on, had a good night.
But the way people respond to something like the Vida Blue story, you know, Cy Young, no hitter, you know, World Series. Pitched his balls off, tripping them off at the same time.
Uh-huh.
And the way we imagine how much of a pitcher he would have been if only he hadn't done that.
Oh, God. People, go home and
it's not enough.
Burn your music. Burn your music. Burn your films. Burn all that stuff. As Bill Hicks, may peace be upon him, stated very clearly, very concisely, all those people were real high. You know, like, it makes me laugh sometimes when I see people talk. And, you know, like, I'll tell you, this one makes me laugh. I don't know if I can trust him anymore.
Yeah, dig it. That game that he pitched where his own face was melting? He pitched a no-hitter.
I don't know if it was.
He pitched a no-hitter.
No-hitter.
You know, a perfect game is 27 up, 27 down. A no-hitter is nobody hit safely in the game. Maybe he walked somebody, or beamed somebody, or somebody reached on an error. But the no-hitter is the most difficult thing in sport. And he did it, for all we know, looking down at his hands as he gripped the ball and seeing octopus tentacles.
Yeah, there's actually a collection of stories regarding people's different famous people's psychotropic experiences, from Cary Grant, who Cary Grant was the one who actually introduced Timothy Leary, and a bunch of those other people. You got Cary Grant, of course, Hunter S. Thompson, a bunch of other writers, Robert Alton Wilson, and all those other guys, and, you know, a lot of the atypicals that you'd expect. Brave New World.
Alice Huxley.
Yeah, Huxley. All these people that, as far as you can tell, if you looked at the list, you'd hold them all in high regard. Generals in the Pentagon. I read that story about the general in the Pentagon who had taken LSD and then walked around the Pentagon. And there used to be a bunch of generals that used to do this. And I couldn't think of a freaking worse trip in my life than a building where everything looks the same and it's just never ends, and I mean, it's just huge long hallways. What a horrible place. I mean, and it's like the main merchant of death on the planet. I mean, I just, that would just be just too much for me to even.
You know, meanwhile, the straight people, like you mentioned earlier, Albert, the straight people. What are the straight people up to? Can't make this up. The straight people, you know, these lips that touch liquor will never touch mine. Your lips? No, my liquor. No, lips that touch liquor will never touch mine. The straight people. Godzilla from Wasilla was... Well, I guess a little bit nervous before her big St. Louis showdown with Joe Biden. You remember that?
Yep.
And so she wanted to have a little communion with the Almighty. So what does she do? Well, she's one of these people that has to hold hands to pray and one hand up and, right.
I love you.
Yeah, I love you. Right. Got to do some swaying.
Yeah, you know? Roll it on the floor.
Yeah, right. And so she wants to do a little bit, and she looks around, and all there are around her are McCain staff people. And she just wasn't going to pray with them McCain people. Heathens.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. This is the account. From Godzilla from Wasilla's own speech, Albert. Okay? This isn't somebody... No, these are her own words.
Okay.
So I'm looking around for somebody to pray with. I just need maybe a little help, maybe a little extra. And the McCain campaign, love them, you know. There are a lot of people around me. But nobody I could find that I wanted to hold hands with and pray. And the crowd laughs. And she grins. And she says that she didn't mean any disrespect to the McCain people. But ultimately, she just prayed with her daughter, Piper. You know, the one named after the airplane in which she was conceived.
Yeah.
Man, the things don't have much in the way of a back seat. Talk about wing walking. That's what the straight people are up to, Albert. I just didn't want to hold hands and pray with none of them because, you know, they're moderate Republicans and you don't know where their hands have been.
Jeez. And you know what's really, really the more really humorous thing about that to me, to about how these people are, like, their drug, that's their drug, is praying. When they pray, it releases, it puts them into a state of, right, what is it, ecstatic? It puts them into an ecstatic state, right? Putting in a trance, being in, you know, sitting there and putting in an ecstatic state, and they're releasing enteogens that your brain carries with you. You know, like when they, you know, it reminds me of...
Yeah, like the endorphins get all cut loose and the serotonin gets unreuptaked and... Right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the most powerful drug on the planet, which exists in all of our heads, which all of us do on a constant basis, every night when you go to sleep, is dimethyltryptamine, okay? And this is something that I keep hearing more and more about. And I start hearing more and more people sound like... I used to sound crazy, you know, years ago, but I've read a bunch of books on this. I've, you know, done as much research as physically possible on it, and I'll tell you what, it's because it's so interesting. Why, Bob, why are we carrying around, why does all life carry around the most potent psychedelic substance on the, I mean, in existence? Why? Why is that? Well, why are we carrying, why did evolution see it necessary for us to have this? And why is it found everywhere? Why can these people sit there, and this is what makes me laugh, you know, my drugs are okay, but your drugs aren't okay, and this is why the whole thing is so stupid. How dare you tell anybody else what they're going to, you know, put out? They can pray all they want. She can pray with whoever, pray with whoever you want. You want to dance until, you want to whirl your dervish until you freaking get, you know, you're on planet Xenon, whatever. Go ahead, do it. As long as you don't hurt anybody, I don't care. You know,
but that's
as,
the problem. You know, the little high that she got on, in spite, you know, when she came down, her God, being a God of blood and blood and gore and death and murder and so forth, she came, you know, when she came back to Earth after her ecstasy, It was like one of those the William Blake woodcuts that's just creepy as hell. And, you know, she came back wanting to hurt things. It's disturbing. I know. Hey, Albert, I'm going to roll along, brother.
All right, brother. You have a great weekend.
You too. This is always so much fun.
Oh, absolutely. Let's hope next week's a little more progressive. How about that?
Yeah, there's a word.
Just praying for a progressive week. All right, brother.
All right, later. Bye now. So we're almost halfway through the program tonight. A couple of lines blinking. I'm going to come to them right back out of the break. Need just a wee little bit of a break. Hopefully you'll hang on and tolerate that for just a minute. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. This is the activist radio that you make possible. I'm Bob. And we are on the way back. Right after this.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention
$24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Dulcet Tones at 27 minutes before the hour of Jimmy Buffet. This is The Horn. I'm Bob. It's Friday night. We're kicking back, relaxing, a little front porch action. And let's check in with our critic at large. Hey, Reverbo.
Hey, Bob. How are you doing tonight?
I'm just mellow.
Well, that's good. Now, the pitcher you're thinking about is actually Doc Ellis.
Oh.
Doc Ellis.
Well, I was reading it was Vida Blue, but you're right, it was Doc Ellis.
Well, Vida Blue did have battle drug problems through his career, too. And he was a great pitcher, but it was, in fact, Doc Ellis when he was a Pittsburgh Pirate who pitched a no-hitter on acid against the San Diego Padres in 1970.
Okay, so once again, I've had my ass burnt by the internet.
Well, you've been shown up by an older caller.
I don't know why I went to Vida Blue, but it just proves to you, Reverbo, if you go looking for something on the internet, you will find it, because I typed in Vida Blue LSD and boom, there was the post.
Well, he had problems And he had problems with coke and a variety of things. But I think the problem with the Doc Ellis story, though, is that only Doc really knows for sure what happened that night. And so could it be an urban legend or not? We don't really know.
Well, that's true, because it's not like you can test for it.
Well, and it's just, it's a great, if I was Doc, I would keep this story alive forever.
Well, but the problem is Doc isn't around to do that. He passed away December 19th of 2008.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Or, then again, I go with the internet again.
Well, it's an internet war. It's great. Next, I will come up with something to top that. But, So the story dies with the Doc, I guess.
And, there's the story. April 8th, 1984, former Pittsburgh Pirates pitcher Doc Ellis says he was under the... I'm so ashamed. They're gonna recall oh my God. They're gonna come get my old baseball mitt or something. Says he was under the influence of LSD when he pitched his 1970 no-hitter against the San Diego Padres.
Yeah. Well, it's easy to get confused. I mean, as if there aren't any other professional athletes that have had some situations come up with drugs. That's never happened before, so...
Well, one of the things that kind of makes it believable, and this would be because one of the most beautiful things about baseball, Reverbo, is the fact that it is a meticulously well-recorded game. And, everything around it, And what Ellis claimed back in 1984 as the coordinator of the anti-drug program in L.A., he said he didn't know until 6 hours before he took the mound that he was going to pitch. He said, I was in Los Angeles. The team was playing in San Diego. I didn't know it. I'd taken LSD. I thought it was an off day. That's how come I had it in me. I took the LSD at noon. And at 1 p.m., his girlfriend, who was tripping with him, said, Doc, you're pitching today. He said, that's when it was $9.50 to fly to San Diego. She got me to the airport at 3:30. I got there at 4:30. Game started at 6:05. It was a twi-night doubleheader. He said, I can only remember bits and pieces of the game. I was psyched. I had a feeling of euphoria. I was zeroed. And this is what, this is what Albert was talking about. I was zeroed in on the catcher's mitt, but I didn't hit the mitt too much. I remember hitting a couple of batters and the bases were loaded two or three times. The ball was small sometimes. The ball was large sometimes. Sometimes I saw the catcher. Sometimes I didn't. Sometimes I tried to stare the hitter down and throw while I was looking at him. I chewed my gum till it turned to powder. They had, about 3 to 4 fielding chances. I remember diving out of the way of a ball I thought was a line drive. I jumped, but the ball wasn't hit hard and never reached me.
God.
He walked 8 batters. The Pirates won 2-0. Call me crazy, but I want to believe it.
I want to believe it, too. I mean, that is showing me something, Doc.
Right. If only he'd left the drugs alone, imagine how good he would have been.
Oh, man.
That's the kind of legendary stuff that, it didn't grow. It didn't grow up around the cannabis. It didn't grow up around coke. I mean, the paradigm for coke is Al Pacino playing Tony Montana. Say hello to my little friend. But these kind of things grow up around, for some reason, LSD. Whether it's either 1, 3, or 5 hits of acid under Jimi Hendrix's bandana at Woodstock, or the guy who originally discovered the stuff riding his bicycle through the streets of whatever city in Switzerland it was, feeling like he was riding against a brick wall, and there's still the legend of him just pedaling like mad. And for the most part, they're cute stories, and with the exception of that reference that Albert has made to Bill, the late, great Bill Hicks, who said, then there's always the idiot that ruins it for the rest of us. He jumped out of the window thinking he could fly.
Yeah, well, I always remember what General Turgidson said about that kind of stuff. We don't want to let one slip up, ruin the entire idea, so... whatever he.
Oh God! The transition to Buck Turgidson. We're cooking tonight.
Well, we're gonna transfer. We're gonna keep moving here to. So you don't mind, do you?
No.
head on over to, well, first of all, happy birthday to your wishes. Happy birthday wishes to your daughter from all of us, I'm sure.
Thank you.
And so the headline today, science is back. But that's no fun because you can't sell any ads with happy stuff. So let's just go into the mad stuff, and it's more fun. So on Science Day, on NPR today, Philippe Cousteau is one of the guests. And I don't know about you, but that show wasn't there for you, but I'm telling you, I never miss the Jacques Cousteau underwater adventure.
Oh, no, when I was a kid? Oh, Jacques Cousteau's on tonight?
Oh, man.
And, you know, my dad, me, mom, just sitting there in rapt attention, watching whatever fascinating thing was coming from the briny deep.
Oh, he'd pull up the diving saucer, and there's Philippe inside, and we're always waving bye-bye to the great whales from the deck of the Calypso. Wave, Philippe, wave. And,
you do that way too well.
No, well, thank you very much. But, of course, Jacques would never go down in the diving saucer because he was scared of giant clams, and he'd send Philippe down there. But no,
there's giant squids down there. Fish pee in that.
Oh, yeah. And that gets, look at you. You are clairvoyant. That gets right to the heart of the subject here, of peeing in the ocean. Well, that's close to the subject anyway. So here's Philippe. Here's Cousteau, and he's talking about our friend, the ocean, right? He's talking about reef destruction, and he's talking about carbon poisoning, how carbon is doing a pH change in the ocean and making it more acidic.
Liberal.
And how, yeah. I mean, by the way, a newsflash, we need the ocean, in case anybody forgot about this. And, you know, the point is here that, humanity depends on nature. That's where he was going with it. Life depends on nature. How this doesn't occur to people, I don't know, but, you know, that's the big point. And then it was really interesting because he said, you know, people treat the environment, let me back up, some people treat the environment as if it's some kind of a luxury. Like, you know, it's...
See, I thought you were going to say some people treat the environment like it's their own personal garbage dump.
They, that too. And I started thinking, you know, they do. It's sort of like, where do you want to go for summer vacation this year? Well, let's go to the environment. I mean, as if it's sort of like you're deciding whether to go to, like, Hawaii or you're going to go, like, a ski vacation. Well, let's go to the environment. Like,
right. Or the corollary to that, the very well-intended corollary to that, Reverbo, let's go do some ecotourism.
Hey, that even sounds cooler, doesn't it?
Terribly destructive. No matter how lightly you try to tread, it's destructive.
This thing is alive. I think it's 7/8 of the planet. You really have to, watch it. You can't just piss it. Like, well, when no one's looking on our vacation to the environment, we can, of course, throw our shit overboard on the boat.
Anybody looking?
Like,
dump it
away really quick.
Yeah.
God, man, I can remember back watching the Calypso, and here's Jacques. And this was back when, like, every boy and girl wanted to be, like, an oceanographer, you know. And you wanted to be something cool like an investigative reporter.
Right. And, I've told the story on the air about how, you know, when I was 4 and 5 years old, people would, you know, little boy, what do you want to be? And, you know, the stocking, I want to be a policeman. I want to be a fireman. You know, that kind of stuff. I want to be a cowboy. I guess I was kind of atypical, 4 or 5 years old, little boy. What do you want to be? I want to be Roger Mudd.
That was atypical. You do that well, by the way.
That was me. And I kind of remind myself of that every now and then, that, you know, even on whatever level I'm doing it on, I'm kind of doing it. How many people can look back to what the, how many 4-year-olds who wanted to be cowboys are cowboys now? How many 4-year-olds who wanted to be policemen are policemen now? But, you know, the other side of that coin that you're referencing here, I think, Reverbo, is the fact that, a lot of us, we watched Jacques Cousteau and National Geographic specials and,
And that was back when National Geographic specials were few and far between. They didn't have their own cable channel, and they came on CBS. And you remember the graphic with the a special. You remember specials? I remember the National Geographic theme music, you know. Look, there's a tiger, a real big tiger, and he is coming right after me. Boom, boom. Yeah. And we wanted to do that. You know,
our aspirations were higher. Somehow Bob, is this before all the madness seeped in?
No, it's before the Republicans got control, daggummit. I mean,
I'm going to ask you a question now, and I think I know the answer to it. But the madness was always there, wasn't it?
It was always lurking under the surface. And, you know, for me, 1964, after Lyndon Johnson beat the stuffing out of Barry Goldwater, you know, in your head, you know he's right, but in your gut, you know he's nuts. They were still regrouping, and Richard Nixon becomes default president by default in 1968 because the entire Democratic Party was torn all to pieces, and the ones who were left standing had both thumbs up their butt. And so Richard Nixon, I'm back, becomes president. But even Richard Nixon, for as crazy a red baiter and a drunk and a freak and a drug addict and a known associate of a war criminal like Henry Kissinger that he was, the guy still turns around and talks to America about crazy stuff like a living, not a minimum, but a living wage, founds the EPA in which all of Appalachia's hopes lie right now. Okay, that Richard Nixon. And you know, you and I are slightly different in age, but, you know, I was born in 1963. So I'm coming up through all this. I want to be Roger Mudd, but I'm also fascinated. Somebody when I was, you know, 10 years old gave me, well, actually when I was maybe 6-7 years old, I discovered in my grandmother's library a book by C.W. Saram called God's Graves and Scholars. And it had these really cool black and white plates in the middle of it of the mummy of King Ramses II with the bandages pulled back. Man, to my little mind, that was better. Oh, dear, I think I'll be taken to a hospital for this. That was like porn. Okay, I can remember a rainy Sunday afternoon when I couldn't go outside, and I'm 6 or 7 years old, and I'm watching black and white television, and it's one of those Sunday things that ABC ran, but they're in Mexico, and they've got these pictures of Aztec carvings and temples and Maya stuff, and oh my God. God, and I'm just, and it seared itself into my brain. I can see, if I could draw, you right now, Reverba, what I saw on the TV screen, and I'd grow up, I'd get out of high school, and there's Ronald Reagan waiting for me, and people saying, well, you know, you can't be one of those. They don't make any money.
Oh, I was going to say, there's this fine point. There's a specific moment. I think it happened around 1970. It happened even before Reagan, but at least by Reagan. Everybody just quit wanting to be oceanographers, and they all went to business school.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just got a little boring.
Yeah, I'm reminded by Frank and Angel in the chat room. She says, when I grow up, I want to be an astronaut. I still got my astronaut helmet. And it had the little wax paper mouthpiece on it, and when you talked, it buzzed like a kazoo. My parents couldn't get that thing off my head. I was born into a world, you know, there's a generation that's older than me, Reverbo, that was utterly crushed by the assassination of John Kennedy. I was too young to really comprehend much of the assassination. You know, I was 10 months old when John Kennedy was killed, but I was 5 years old when Martin and Bobby were killed, okay? But there was the world that they had started sort of roughing out in pencil. And it was a world where we explored space, and we explored underwater, and we explored the vast reaches of unexplored terra firma. And there was science, and there were brilliant doctors and scientists, and all this was even being taught in the public schools of a little town in Alabama. And there was no moral majority, Reverbo. And there were no right-wing freaks marching up and down outside saying, don't let the kid dissect the frog in biology class. He'll think he comes from one. It wasn't there. And then you hit your late adolescence, early adulthood. And, yeah, brick wall. So, sorry, I didn't mean to hijack your call.
You didn't. No, you didn't hijack my call. The nuts hijacked our life. The nuts hijacked our aspirations.
Yeah, our hope.
We went to the moon and never went back. I mean, I never understood that. Nothing interesting up there, huh?
Well, you know, they brought back enough rocks for all the school children to see.
Last night you were talking about, the response to any suggestion, you know, for any legislation to protect people or to put people first, the response to anything that's good is either no or it's going to destroy the economy. Remember, it was just on and on and on. I mean, their motto, hey, saying no since 1933.
There you go.
And, I mean, they've just, well, I was very happy. But once again, before I called you, I was all happy. Now I don't know. Now
then I did it again.
Where I am, it's backwards thinking. these people just want to kill everything that gets in the way. I'll tell you, though.
Oh, yeah, look, it's straight out of that line from I Shot the Sheriff. Kill it before it grows. What? That little kid's embracing hope and thinks he can do something and be something, and he's a little middle-class kid, and he's got hopes and dreams? Kill it before it grows!
Well, science is back. Obama's bringing science back. He has to, and I think he's going to. But I'll tell you, it's going to be tough. They really do have realize that it is just one loud drunk at the end of the bar. It is a shrieking but unpleasantly loud and ignorant group of morons. You know, and they just agree with these people anytime they say anything stupid. But it's just a bunch of loudmouths, so we just have to ignore them. I mean, it's like these people that you run into in West Virginia. Your story that you started with tonight. I was thinking, you know, the world isn't going to come to an end. We're not going to freeze to death because we stopped mining coal. The world's going to come to an end because human beings stop using their brains.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
That's what it is.
I mean, there's stuff that, you know, politically, culturally, there's stuff that continues to drive me just batty. I mentioned at the top of the program that Harry Reid's mad at us all now. He's mad. Cool. Harry Reid is mad at you.
Why?
You liberal? He was at a breakfast briefing this morning. Christian Science Monitor hosted it. Our blogger, Texas Betsy, cued me in on this. And, you know, there are some ad campaigns out there from progressive organizations that are putting pressure on these flim-flammy, wishy-washy, mug-wumpy, so-called moderate Democrats in the Senate who want to make sure that, you know, that Obama can't get away with all that liberalizing. So somebody asks him about these ads, these targeted ads aimed at so-called moderate Democrats. And Harry said, you know, that bastion of bravery, can't stand up to the Republicans, but by God, he can tell a liberal where to get off. That's the corner of go to hell and screw you, for anybody, you know, wondering. He said, I think it's very unwise and not helpful. These groups should leave them alone. Leave Britney alone! These groups should leave them alone. It's not helpful to me. It's not helpful to the Democratic caucus. Legislation is the art of compromise. Consensus building. You know, this guy can't muster. He can't muster enough.
Is that guy even alive? What? Let's just hope that Barack has planned. You know, he's on the list, and Barack will get to him in due time.
You know who Harry Reid reminds me of? When he gets when Harry gets about 20 years older, he's going to be just like the old man on Family Guy that's always inviting Chris into the basement for a popsicle.
I'll just have to take your word.
Okay, sorry, not a Family Guy guy. Okay.
I tried. I
know.
Never got into it. What can I say?
But you know, you liberals need to leave the moderates alone. Quit being mean to the moderates, liberals. Quit thinking that we're going to get something like the Employee Free Choice Act passed. Yeah, my God, a guy who I'm getting to the point where I loathe this man more than I do most Republicans. Ben Nelson of Nebraska. I mean, this is I am fast approaching the wouldn't pee on him to put out a fire status, and you know that's mostly
Democrat. Oh God.
He says he's going to vote against Obama's budget if they use the budget reconciliation process. That's a deal breaker. I don't think it's appropriate to determine the health care delivery system, the changes that will be there through the reconciliation process. Stunning, ain't it?
What are the requirements for becoming a senator or congressman in this country? I forget.
I think if you're from the Midwest, a lobotomy is in order.
Yeah. Well, why don't these people change? Now, here's an idea. I was looking at a list today on Wikipedia of the looking at our senators, our current senators, and some of our current governors. And I was here. We go once again with you. And you were talking about, you know, who these people are, and they're easy to spot, and they've lived there their whole lives. They've lived there for many lives, and it's the remnants of the old Confederacy, right? That's who these people are.
Forget hell.
I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're named Shaxby and Johnny and Jeffy and Sammy and you know, this.
Yes.
It's easy. By the way, in doing this exploration, I found something everyone might be interested in. I had no clue. In Idaho, and I'm not. Yeah, I guess I'm making fun of their names. That's exactly what I'm doing. The Republican senator from Idaho is named Mike Crapo.
Yes, indeedy. He pronounces it Crapo. That's a long A. Just like in Ohio, John Boehner is Boehner.
Right.
Not Boner.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what I would do if I was him, for sure. And the governor of Idaho, by the way, is named Butch Otter, which is just as amusing. It's not particularly...
Is he kin to one of those girls from the women's college in Animal House?
When do you lose the name? You're a grown man. When do you lose the nickname Butch? I don't.
He's from Idaho. Butch? It may be his given name.
Butch Otter. God, what a great name that is. But look, to get back to what I was thinking, why don't these people just go ahead and change all their first names? Just get it done and change him to Big Daddy and be done with it. Just make it official.
Well, because that's the official nickname of Robert C. Byrd.
Well, then he should lend it to them all. Because all these people are trapped in just this hideous Tennessee Williams play, and they're going to be there for eternity.
Damn it, Big Daddy!
Well, now Bobby Jindal, he's going to have to be Daddy Jr.
Piyush. Piyush. Name ain't Bobby.
But
Piyush.
No. But I mean, it's sort of like, you know, you
can. And can we just finish the job then, Reverbo? Their names are all going to be Big Daddy, but they all got one. Any Southerner knows they all got one last name. Snopes. They're Snopeses. They are all Snopeses.
Hey, who are those big, fat, ugly sparks over there? Well, son, that's Big Daddy Snopes and all the other senators from the South.
It's like, you know, it winds up being like a Southern version of a Monty Python sketch. Howdy, Big Daddy Snopes. How you doing, Big Daddy Snopes? You know, the Bruces. Remember that? G'day, Bruce. How are you, Bruce? Good enough, Bruce.
Yeah,
but it's all Snopeses.
I just say make it official and just get it done. It's sort of, you know, history can go, you know, how would they think about this? After that, you know, decisive whooping they took back in the election of 08, and they were beaten by a black guy. They just never got over it, so they all fully, how do you put this? They fully embraced their inner moron and just assumed the first name of Big Daddy, all of them.
Yeah, it was the, it's just one big second Joe Louis match. It's the Louis Schmeling rematch.
Oh, God. You just hope one day you can just visit some of them in zoos.
Well, you know, our good friend Mike Malloy, was casting about trying to find a new name for the Republican Party since they stopped actually being the Republican Party, and he has gone simply for the Limbaugh Party, and I think that's good as far as it goes. But if you really want to tap into the southernness of the problem, it's the Snopes Party, and of course, you know, I think people who haven't read William Faulkner know what a Snopes is.
No, I was headed right there. Yes, you're right there already. What is that? As I lay dying.
There's Snopes is all for. There's Snopes is in short stories. There's Snopes is in As I Lay Dying. There's Snopes is in and what it is is they are the low rent trash who eventually overcomes what's the well to do family from Sound and the Fury. They overcome all of those and take complete control of Yoknapatawpha County. But even people who haven't read Faulkner know what a Snopes is. You know, the Snopeses are the center of that great short story, The Barn Burning. And they're just, you know, they're no good, ne'er do well, couldn't trust them with the carcass of a dead skunk, wouldn't throw a bucket of warm spit on them if they were on fire, just no good. And that's what the Republican Party is now. They're just all Snopeses.
Well. I hate to have this keep coming back to this geography, but I'm sorry, that's just where it seems to be. I mean, these people just want to drive off to heaven in their coal-powered Escalades. I mean, I just don't get it. And it's just back to what Cousteau's son was talking about. It's like this whole idea that they just, we're battling these people, a bunch of people, and they get obviously a lot of this from that fundamentalist religious just horse crap that is just spoon-fed them, and this whole laissez-faire concept of just dominate the world. We are separate from the world, and we are going to just beat it. We're going to beat it down.
Well, there you have just landed in the middle of the most toxic cesspool of all of Southern right-wing theology, and that is dominionism. This,
okay.
You know, they take this, you know, this verse in Genesis, I think it is, you know, yea, verily, lo, and I say to you, forsooth, I give you dominion over the earth and all of its yada yada. And they, and corporate America tells fundamentalist America that what that literally means, and, you know, it has to be the literal meaning, of course, or the fundamentalists won't get on board, is that what that means is that God has given a pass to every Bible-believing Christian on earth to wreck the place.
Yeah, pretty much.
And even if you're a fundamentalist, how do you get your head around that? Yeah, well, the New Jerusalem's on the way. We've got to kill the planet before Jerusalem can get here.
Huh? You know, it's going to be really interesting how they react to, let's say, the ice caps continue to melt. And I actually have read about these scenarios. I don't know how realistic this is, but it is definitely possible. Do you know, and I know, a lot of people who pay attention, people who critically think and examine things, if the ocean, you know what happened to like California and all our food, if the level of the ocean went up like a foot?
Yes, I do know.
All our religious fundamentalist friends would all starve to death. Along with you and me. Now, I don't know how they reconcile all this stuff, but God, whatever. I don't know what drugs they're.
Well, now daggummit, Reverbo, you got your theology all bass ackwards.
Damn, I always do this.
You said that they were going to starve along with you and me. They're not.
I forgot about the rapture. I forgot. About
they're going to be raptured, and that's going to be the tribulations that we have earned. Depending on which flavor you are, premillennial, postmillennial, hard shell, soft shell. But they're going to be gone. They're going, I'll fly away, old glory, I'll fly away.
with their pants or without their pants.
You know, that discussion gets people killed. Here it is. You know, and the shiv goes in.
Yeah, well, are your clothes going to stay behind? These are questions I'm concerned about.
I don't see how they can. I just don't see how they can. I mean, consider. The book says that the dead in Christ who were buried at sea will come up first. That's going to be something right out of a Romero movie.
Oh, no, I can't. No. Would they use...
Now we just know the clothes ain't going to last.
No, they have to. The only thing worse than this would be this naked. No. The clothes go with a bed. The peach-colored leisure suits, Bob, go with them.
even if it was some fundamentalist who got hit by a shark?
I don't know. We're just going to have to... I don't know. Doc Ellis may be, behind all of this, for all we know.
I know. But again, you know, that goes back to something Albert and I were talking about, and I think fits in well with our conversation. This stuff has all been made up by unaltered, unsubstance of straight people. I don't mean sexually straight. I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, I see what. Yeah, this has not come from the mouths of left wing hippies. This has not come from drug addled college students and fraternity boys. This is straight out of the sobering minds of.
I think this is what happens when you don't let that incredibly addictive, mind-altering substance that exists in the mind of every human loose once in a while. You know, I've talked before, Reverbo. You know, when I go to sleep at night, mostly I refer to, you know, I'll roll over and look at Agnes and say, good night, I'll see you in the morning after my mind movies. And I have these incredibly vivid dreams that are, you know, not quite as creepy as a David Lynch movie. But they're really interesting.
Ain't they, though?
And I think, you know, I think that's some of that chemistry getting loose in my brain. And, you know, some, you know, 10,000 years, 15,000, 20,000, 30,000 years ago, people, 100,000 years ago, people woke up after that and said, I have seen God. Follow me. I know the rules. And, you know, Kronk over there says, but I had a dream, too. You had the wrong dream. I had the right dream. Oh, well, we're going to follow you then. Boom, religion.
I can get that sun back. I can get the sun back behind that eclipse in about 6 minutes. But y'all got to pay me $100.
Yeah, or give me half your harvest. And your virgin
girls.
Daughters.
And your girls, yeah.
Yeah.
You got to throw the girls in. Don't
give me the ugly ones.
You can see them working. Well, I got to go check my possum traps, so...
All right, then. Yeah, water possums?
Well, those ocean possums, they're, yeah. You've probably tasted a few of those, haven't you?
Sadly, no. I've had some tuna.
Might we have some this evening?
I'm thinking we're going to. I'm thinking we're going to right now.
Well, I think that would be a great idea. We'll see how your the audience responds. They may demand surf music after this.
They may very well. Reverbo, have a great weekend, brother.
Make it personal, my friend.
You too. Bye now.
All right. Bye.
That is critic at large, Reverbo, who has suggested that we have a little musical treat this evening, which we will do forthwith. A little... Southern culture on the skids. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice, activist radio, and yeah, sometimes we kick back on a Friday night. This is the horn.
tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Yes, indeed. About 10 minutes, 11 minutes past the hour now. And time for a treat. The hardest working man in liberal talk, Ben Birch, has taken a break and going to hang out with us for a little bit. Hey, Ben.
Hey there, Bob.
What's up?
First of all, about the possums there, go ahead and eat the possums, but don't eat the squirrels.
Mad squirrel disease.
Mad squirrel disease, yeah, bovine spongiform encephalopathy.
Not fun. And it doesn't kick in until, like, you know, years after.
2020 or so. Yeah. But no squirrels.
No.
Tasty, though, they are.
You know what? You'd be surprised the number of people around here who will say, and I'd say that they're at risk, you know, I used to love me some fried squirrel brains.
Yeah, well, you know, frying doesn't kill that stuff because
it ain't alive.
You can almost burn it to an ash and it doesn't kill this stuff.
Right, because it wasn't alive. Protein. I mean, it's not a living,
Yeah, it's like a catalyst. So if it touches other proteins like itself, they all fold up wrong. And then you're dead.
You go crazy first.
Yeah. But anyways, on a happy note, first of all, the naval research lab cold fusion claim.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be extraordinarily suspicious of any claim coming out of a U.S. government military lab. These are the very same people that thought that they were going to get, like, you know, remote viewers to be able to tell us what the Russians were doing.
True, especially in their theoretical divisions. And, you know, the other side of that is when we talk about something like cold fusion, we being liberals, we think about all the marvelous peacetime human potential enhancing uses it might have.
The Navy wants to run submarines.
Or make a death ray.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they're already, well, you know, what they really need is they really need a really compact, extremely strong power source for ships, because what they've got now is a thing called a rail gun, which is it basically shoots a projectile out at about 12 times the speed of a rifle bullet, like nearly escape velocity, so that they can put an exact amount of energy behind it, so that barring winds and a few other things they have to take into account, they can hit a target 120 miles away with it. And probably, given the fact that they've got satellites to help them guide it, they can hit it on the second shot, only one ranging shot.
Don't even really have to lead them anymore, do you?
Oh, no. One ranging shot, the satellite sees where the splash went and corrects, and the next one, which is coming in 37 seconds, is going to hit.
You know, I know you love mechanical trivia and so forth. Found out something today.
Hmm.
There were a couple of brothers lived just down the road back in the 19th century. Their last name was Wood. And they laid out the initial theoretical design for a firearm that would fire by crank.
Uh-huh.
Almost perpetually, as long as you could keep feeding shells into the hopper. Shortly before filing the patent documents for his Gatlin gun, Mr. Gatlin came and visited the Wood Boys in West Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And went away and got stinking rich.
And, you know, the sad thing is the Gatlin gun was not a very effective weapon. It was a terror weapon.
Right.
If you saw that the guys guarding that coal mine to keep you from bothering the scabs had a couple of those Gatling guns, you just stayed away. Because they scared people to death, but they weren't accurate.
No, well, they were shooting monstrous bullets.
Yeah, but the rate of fire was low, and they weren't accurate. They just weren't weapons. And, you know, the range wasn't even very good.
But it did provide the, I guess, intellectual engineering impetus for, was it a brilliant man by the name of Mauser?
Yep.
Thought so.
Yep. Use the gas from the shell to eject the cartridge and load and cock a new one.
The broom handle. Yeah. Winston Churchill, when he rode into the Battle of Khartoum, something like that.
Yep.
He was a member of the Lancers, but instead of carrying a lance like a dummy, he carried the Mauser broom handle that Mama had sent him.
Yep.
And lived to tell the tale.
Yep. Oh yeah. You know, I mean, hey, if you're gonna have a drunk as your leader, at least you ought to have one that's got some bravery behind him, you know?
Very true.
But anyway, so the other thing is, don't assume that fusion's clean. Okay? You've got some real problems here. First of all, I'm not entirely sure we're going to see sustainable fusion in even the current international test reactor that they're building. The mathematics of containing a plasma that you're heating and rotating and pumping new deuterium into at the same time, you know, while you're attempting to make it create fusion, it's not terribly solvable problem. A lot of the stuff is solved. Like, well, we know that it almost worked and we did it this way last time, so we're going to change this a little bit. And there's no real theoretical underpinning to say that they're really right about that.
No, this is adding salt to the stew.
Yes. And the other thing is that you've got a real problem in that when this fusion happens, You get a couple of things that occur. First of all, a lot of the energy that is produced is not produced in the form of heat. It's produced in the form of neutrons. And those neutrons have to be captured somehow in a way that makes heat in order to get the reaction to be efficient enough to make power. And the other thing those neutrons do is when a neutron hits the metal in the walls of the container, or the magnets that surround it that keep it going, it transmutes the atoms in there into some other kind of atom, and this can weaken steel, and these things have to be very strong in order to resist the magnetic forces that are involved, because otherwise they'd want to crush themselves. The thing that happened at CERN with the Large Hadron Collider there, the magnets actually tore it to shreds when something bad happened and the superconducting magnets quenched, and the field when it was released suddenly pulled everything to the side, and it didn't have enough resisting, there weren't thrust bearings strong enough to resist that pull to one side, and the whole thing almost tumbled like a series of dominoes. Okay? Only saved by it, like, kinking in one place from it going all the way around. That's why it was such a mess. But, so there's a lot of force involved here. And, you know, I've been in the magnet test facility at Fermilab where I did a lot of the software years ago, and I saw a magnet get itself loose and move it, you know, and we're talking several tons of magnet, move itself several feet before it pulled the cables loose and the field died.
Wow.
Okay, that was just it pulling against the Earth's magnetic field. So we're talking very strong magnets. The other thing is that the chemistry of superconducting magnet wire is very particular and very sensitive to minor flaws in that wire. And when you start transmuting elements in that wire in this big magnet you've got wrapped around this fusion torus, eventually you create a flaw in that magnet. And what happens is that little spot, that little teeny flaw, becomes no longer superconducting. And when that little spot becomes no longer superconducting, instead of passing the electricity through without resistance, it has a little bit of resistance, and a little bit of resistance means a little bit of heat. And a little bit of heat grows in a superconducting magnet because
to a whole lot of heat.
Yeah, it makes the parts next to it no longer superconducting, and it's a chain reaction, and pretty soon that whole magnet is trying to glow cherry red, and it's blowing the helium all out the vents, and it's no longer a superconducting magnet, it's a slag pile. And unfortunately, it's also a radioactive slag pile because you've been bombarding it with neutrons.
So the
chances of hot fusion done with the magnets, the way we're all thinking they're going to try to do it, actually working any time real soon now is fairly small. We got to keep trying, but it's really very small. Now, there's one thing that might actually work. It's hot fusion, but it's not hot fusion with magnets. And it goes back to a guy named Philo T. Farnsworth. Do you know who he was?
God, I recognize that name.
He is a farm boy from Nebraska who invented television.
And
had it stolen from him.
And then got ripped off. Right, yeah.
But Philo T. Farnsworth invented the Vidicon tube, the important sensor necessary to be able to, at the other end, have a cathode ray tube make an image. And it was based upon something he drew on the chalkboard when he was in high school for his science teacher. And his science teacher said, kid, that could work. You should build it. And Philo T. Farnsworth invented the television and invented a lot of other vacuum tube technology. And one of the technologies he worked on was a thing called a multipactor, which was an amplification tube involving a plasma in a bottle, basically. And the plasma provided amplification. Because you pump this plasma and the electrons would fly back and forth, across the middle of this tube in which was a grid of wires, electrodes to keep the electron plasma moving about. But unfortunately, multipactors distort really badly, and the multipactor effect is.
Is this where we get that notion of that came along a couple of a decade or so of fusion in a jar?
This is fusion in a jar. He invented a thing. He realized, hey, I can do this with electrons. I can do this with protons too. And so he injected hydrogen, or deuterium actually. Into this jar, into a multipactor, a modified multipactor, and he had a thing on a desktop. It was actually they built the very first one on a serving cart from the cafeteria. That made fusion neutrons. You just turned it on, adjusted it properly, and you better stand back because you're going to get irradiated.
Oh my God.
Neutrons. It is a fusion device. It'll sit there on your table.
See, the thing I love about all this theoretical physics and theoretical science, and it's the same thing I love about science fiction, and I know you're a bit of an aficionado too, is that, as I've said before, somebody has to dream it.
Exactly. Well, Philo Farnsworth was a dreamer and a tinkerer and the sort who didn't let anything stop him. Well, he and a guy named Hirsch improved upon the fuser, the Farnsworth fuser. And they eventually got quite a large number of fusion neutrons out of there. Nothing even close to break even. They were pumping in more energy than they were getting out.
And that's always the problem, isn't it? It's the break even issue.
That's right. And neutrons again, you have to have a jacket to turn those neutrons into heat. Jacket, for example, that captures the neutrons and the lead warms up and eventually becomes molten lead, and the molten lead is good enough to make, is to make steam, and the steam is what drives the, et cetera. But the problem with a Farnsworth fuser is once you get the intensity up, not all of those protons hit, not all those protons miss the electrodes. The protons hit the electrodes, heat them up, and cause...
Same problem as you had with the magnet.
Yes. Well, it erodes them. And the erosion means that eventually you burn out your filament. And so there are people all over this country who are fusion hobbyists making these multi-pactor fusion devices and hoping they will come up with a breakthrough of some sort to make it work.
Yeah, the infinite monkeys, infinite typewriters approach to scientific breakthroughs.
There was a very smart man named Dr. Bussard, who, if you read any Larry Niven stories,
yes,
you know who he was, because he thought of the idea you could build a fusion-powered spaceship that would pull in hydrogen from the vacuum with big magnets and fuse that, and so you didn't have to carry any fuel with you. It was called a Bussard ramjet. But Dr. Bussard, before he died a couple years ago, was working on a device called the Polywell. And again, he was working on it for the Naval Research Lab. The Polywell is a series of magnets and basically charged electrodes that are also magnets, where the magnets do some of the containment, and they keep the vibrating back and forth, from one side to the other, protons all the way inside, so that they don't actually hit the magnets, and they don't actually heat the magnets up, because the magnetic field, there's basically a magnet that is also electrostatically charged. So it serves both the purpose of the Farnsworth fuser's electrode and the purpose of a magnet to keep these protons the heck away from the electrode. And he believed that if he went one or two more steps, he'd have something that you could make commercial power with.
Well, when these guys work at this stuff and then they eventually die off, is their work translatable, Ben?
Well, yes.
I mean, can it be picked up and worked with some more?
Well, Farnsworth's long gone, and people are still working with his stuff, and that's what Bussard was doing. And there's a group now that is in fact building. Well, they've got keep alive funding from the Naval Research Lab to build some instrumentation for the next thing they wanted to build. But they've not been fully funded. But if they ever do get fully funded with the Polywell, there is just a good chance that he's going to be able, that this group is going to be able to make this work. And so the thing that will probably, in my mind, the most likely fusion power plant that we'll ever build is going to be very cheap. It's going to be very compact, very, very safe. You'll be able to put these, a few hundred yards from any dwelling place without anybody really worrying about them. They can't melt down, and the jacket catches all the neutrons anyway. And yes, there's some hot stuff to clean up when you're all done running the thing in 30 years and build a new one, but not nearly the amount you get out of a fission plant. And it will be based on an idea from a farm boy from Nebraska who invented television.
Cool. Just cool.
Yep. So that's the story with fusion. Fusion's a chimera. Fusion has been the power source of the next decade my entire life.
It's been the philosopher's stone of the modern era.
Exactly. Much more likely, there's a thing that Carlo Rubbia, Nobel Prize winner from CERN, came up with a number of years ago, and an idea I have been pushing at people for the last 20 years, called an energy amplifier. And what this is, thorium is one of the most common of radioactive elements. Okay?
Yes.
You find thorium, there is a lot of thorium on this planet, far more than there is uranium, certainly far more than there is, good uranium, 235. We make lantern mantles out of thorium, or we used to. That's why those Coleman lanterns were always a little bit radioactive. Because you'd put that little bag in there and you'd have to burn the bag.
Oh yeah, I've done that.
Well, the ash, what's left over when you burn away the cotton, is this thorium wire that they had wove very fine thorium wire that they had woven into the cotton. And that's what the ash is. And that thorium was where the catalytic burning occurred in the Coleman lantern. But so thorium is very common. But thorium, you make a pile out of thorium, you can stack as much thorium as you want, and you're not going to have a chain reaction because thorium does not have enough of a capture cross-section to make enough neutrons. You pump a couple of neutrons into a thorium pile, and there's a few additional fissions after the couple that it hits, but enough actually escapes the pile that the chain reaction cannot occur. But what you do is, there have been some thorium reactors, but they have always had something else to make neutrons in them, like a little bit of plutonium or a little bit of uranium-235. And the CANDU reactors that Canada built were like that. There's a couple that the Indians built, in their research labs that were thorium reactors that had another neutron source. They had enough fissile material of another sort to make the neutron. But what you do instead of having anything except thorium in this pile is you surround this pile with a lead jacket. Okay, into this lead jacket, you fire like a 500 million electron volt proton beam, which we absolutely know how to make medical facilities use proton beams of that size. All right, it's a very simple proton accelerator. It's a very small.
I love the way you throw the word "simple" around, Ben.
Well, and compared to CERN.
Yes.
Okay. Compare to a real research accelerator, and it's very simple.
I mean, I'm a guy who wears slip-ons because I'm challenged by shoelaces. Okay.
This is just a bunch of magnets and a vacuum tube in between them. You know, that evacuated tube that the protons can fly through. You inject ionized hydrogen at one end, and the magnets pull it all the way through the other end. When it comes out the other end, it's moving very fast. These protons slam into the molten lead that surrounds this thorium pile, and a thing called neutron spallation occurs. The protons bang into the lead, and they strip neutrons from the lead. These neutrons are what fly into the pile and make it have fusion, and make it make heat, and the molten is what takes the heat away. And this is very, very safe because if anything goes wrong with it, you kill the switch and that proton accelerator stops. And so does the reactor.
You know,
very promptly.
I think there's something to be observed out of this whole conversation, Ben. And that is that we're engaged in it with a sort of underlying assumption that all of this is, A, worth doing, and, B, possibly might be done.
Well, that's going to be done.
Well, and but work with me here. For the last 8 years, we didn't talk like this.
No, there was no future in it.
For the last 8 years, science was a myth. It was something we used to do. But whether it's you know, high-level theoretical physics like what you're describing, or the considerably more prosaic the business of advancing solar, wind, geothermal, wave action energy technologies, we've got a promise from the President of the United States that, you know, the door to science is back open. I saw an editorial cartoon the other day that showed a fellow leading three people in white coats out of a cave, and the daylight was labeled reality, and the people in the white coats were labeled science.
Yep.
And the guy in the guy that was leading them out said, "Easy there, let your eyes adjust to the light." And it struck me as being so incredibly true. All of this stuff, you know, whether it's something that's been going to happen the next decade for the last four, or something that may be 100 years away, at least I have the sense now, Ben, that we're actually going to work on it.
See, that's that. I mean, and I know it seems like everything comes home to West Virginia for me. I can't help it. West Virginia is home.
Well, there's a couple of good, really good reasons for beyond carbon and keeping the pretty mountains to leave West Virginia's coal where it is. Because no matter what we do, no matter what we do with finding an alternative energy source, we still don't have any other way to make steel except the good metallurgical coal that comes out of West Virginia. It's very much too good to burn.
Yeah. But where's it been going?
China, because they don't have any good metallurgical coal. If we would ever stop, if we would ever say we won't be exporting any more coal, China's industry would come to a halt. We wouldn't have to worry about them anymore because they wouldn't be able to make steel. There's only a couple other spots on the planet you can get good metallurgical coal anymore, and they're not big enough to fuel China.
And, you know, what's to keep us from saying, oh, God, guys, sorry, just ran out. Only got enough for ourselves.
Or put an excise tax on it that means that we could balance the federal deficit in a year.
And you know, because I've got this notion,
because
Ben.
It's like crack, you know, they have to have it.
You know, science, again, because it's science, science is not influenced by desperation.
You want nothing's going to work any faster than it's going to work.
If science was motivated by desperation, the Nazis would have gotten the atomic bomb long before we did.
Yep.
Because we were kind of casual about it. But they were working, you know, with dogged, single-minded determination.
Yep.
And so, you know, you can't count on desperation to give you your next scientific breakthrough. As such, you know, what you mentioned about good metallurgical coal is absolutely true. But also, it's got to be noted that when the energy, you know, because nobody's got a real good handle on how much coal is left in the ground, especially in Appalachia. I mean, you know, you've got the Powder Basin fields and stuff, and my God, they've got 100-foot high seams of coal, but it's really lousy coal.
It's very bad coal. It's almost lignite.
And they're, you know, they are at this point, John Wathen was telling me, they are mining, they're basically mining brown mud in Mississippi now and calling it coal.
Yep.
You know, Canada, Western Canada is being absolutely tormented for its tar sands.
Yep.
And so it sort of seems to me that we need to be focusing not, while we've got the luxury of not being desperate, that we focus on getting the next step, whether it's a fusion issue or whether, like I said, it's the more prosaic things of advancing lithium battery technology.
Exactly.
You know, there's still plenty of room for advancement in battery technology. It is, in fact, it's the 800-pound gorilla in the room of solar energy.
When they tell us we can't afford to pump money into the economy, what they are telling us is that we can't afford to find anything to replace the coal and oil they still own shares in.
There you go. And you know, the stimulus business had literally billions of dollars for this phony ass clean coal technology.
Yeah.
I found it quite telling. You know how it is with Wall Street. Wall Street, you know, anything that appears to make money comes along. Oh, well, you know, this is the best thing since sliced bread. The Wall Street Journal owns a website that I'm sure you're familiar with called MarketWatch.
Yep.
Okay. A liberal bastion, this ain't.
No, and they're not even sold.
Well, lo and behold, there's a column today by a guy named Thomas Costigan. And it's headlined, The Clean Coal Myth, Commentary, with Commodities Future in Doubt, Industry Scrambling. And you know what he ends with?
No.
Coal players need to open their eyes and see what's coming. Instead, they are squandering an opportunity. We should be mad at them just as much as we are mad at the finance industry that fooled us into subprime mortgages and false profits. Let's not get fooled again by the myth of clean coal. It's dirty by nature.
Anyone who's ever cleaned out a steam engine will tell you this.
Sure.
And I have.
We're not involved in the reality business. This is Tinkerbell theory. This is stuff that has no grounding in a natural ordered world. We can just say, wow, because I mean, every day here in this region, I hear we've got 250 years of coal still in the ground. Well, Ben,
we have 50,000 years of thorium still in the ground.
Oh, there's that, but the other side of this is that they've been saying there's 250 years of coal in the ground since 1970.
Yep.
Meanwhile, usage and demand has been going up incrementally, but exponentially.
If we were cracking this coal to make town gas to replace natural gas wells that are all running out, if we were cracking this coal to put through a Tropsch catalytic, process to make something that's vaguely like gasoline, if we were doing those things with that coal, it wouldn't last us 50 years.
And that's what they want to do. There's a coal-to-liquids facility planned for Ohio. There's another one planned for southern West Virginia. And it takes, at a minimum, 3 gallons. And this is the liberal estimate. This is, if we really, really do it right. It takes 3 gallons of fresh, pure, clean, incredibly finite water.
Yep.
For every gallon of liquid coal, and it's like what you were talking about with the fusion project. You pump more energy into it than you get out of it.
Exactly. The same, by the way, is true. Don't let anyone tell you that corn ethanol is a good idea. It isn't. That corn ethanol is a net energy loss.
Oh, that's the biggest carnival sideshow to come along in a long time. I go to put gas in the truck, and I pull up the minute and it says 10% ethanol. And I'm like, I guess the average Joe putting fuel in his tank is, wow, okay, damn them Saudis. Yeah, we got them over a barrel now. That's 10% ethanol.
Actually, 10% is a good idea to put in, even if it doesn't make you anything, because it reduces emissions.
Yeah, it's not doing anything to reduce overall energy consumption.
No, it's an additive.
It's STP.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. The other thing about the energy amplifier. Here's the good thing about it. Yucca Mountain, no one likes it.
Right.
Especially the people in Nevada don't like it. We could bury all that nuclear waste and try to keep it safe for the next, 20,000 years. Or, if you have a series of energy amplifiers making power in various places, you just take this nuclear waste, this high-level waste, and you put it into little capsules. And each one of these reactors, when you go in and you're doing maintenance on it and fueling on it, you take a new little capsule and take the old one out. The old one has now been irradiated by the neutrons from the thorium pile for so long that it has turned mostly into lead.
Jesus.
It's been burned. It's energy. The energy that was still residual in it, and there's actually quite a bit in spent nuclear fuel, has
and it's been combusted.
Pile run. And been used. And what you've mostly got there is lead and a few species of mercury that are radioactive that have a fairly short half-life. And you take this little hot capsule out and you keep it somewhere for 20 years, and then it's safe to bury with the low-level waste.
Jesus.
So that's the other...
Well, this is the kind of stuff we look into. I'm just kind of resentful over the couple of billion dollars we're going to throw down the clean coal rat hole. As opposed to pumping it into this stuff that actually makes sense.
You know, there is one reason we have to do that, and that is because we'll never get this other stuff funded as long as we have these senators from the coal states sitting on their votes.
Yeah, and see, that's the thing. clean coal technology, Ben, is a science vampire.
It's not really a science vampire because there are no real scientists that are going to ever go work on that.
Oh, but they are. They already are. I mean, they're, you know, you saw future, you saw that ginned up, rubed up, faked up, dummied up thing out in southern Illinois, you know, future gen. It turns out, you know, the word's out on that. That thing was nothing but a PR stunt. But at places like Carnegie Mellon and MIT, there are guys funded by the coal companies sitting around trying to figure out how to make carbon not be carbon.
My opinion is the people who are working on that know they're really no damn good, and this is the best thing they can get. The really good people are doing something else.
I mean, for all intents and purposes, they're sitting around working on the universal solvent.
Exactly, and they know it, and they know that. But they also know that they really don't have any other future in science because, again, they're not that good. They can either do this.
In other words, they're hacks.
Somebody else's lab assistant.
They're hacks.
They're hacks.
Jimmy.
So let the hacks do their thing. The waste of money is the worst part. But at the same time, we have got to fund the other energy technologies. We've got to look at three important principal things. Thing number one is the highly experimental things like the polywell. Thing number two are the practical things you could actually consider doing in the short term to make energy. Things like the energy amplifier. The physics of that are well known. The engineering is not hard, and we really ought to be doing those things. And the third thing that we need to do is we need to seriously consider what we're going to do with the carbon dioxide that is already in the atmosphere, because we've really already gone too far. And what we have to consider is building enough additional nuclear power, be it fission, you know, the thorium fission, the energy amplifier, be it fusion, to be able to run really huge radio frequency pulse devices that will break the carbon dioxide apart in the air, and carbon will rain out and oxygen will come out the stack.
Wow.
And,
that's planetary.
People talk about carbon sequestration, where they're talking about, you know, liquefying the CO2 and pumping it into the deep ocean or something. And that's just asking for a disaster.
Well, it's nuts.
Instead, let's turn it back into coal.
I mean, giant scientific super duper septic tank is basically what they're talking about.
That's right, and it's all down there where if anything disturbs it, it'll come back up again all at once.
You know, I've heard that. Yeah, in fact, we've got brilliant people who listen to this program. Who do all kinds of things, like travel around on the ocean floor and watch volcanoes get born.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you love to see one of those carbon sequestration the thingamajigs sitting down on top of a vent?
There is a lake, actually there's a couple of them, but there's a lake in Africa where there is a volcanic vent under it that pumps carbon dioxide into the deep water. And that carbon dioxide builds up over many years in this lake. And eventually, something disturbs the layer of carbon dioxide that is down there. And all of the CO2 boils to the surface of the lake all at once. And the last time it happened, several villages, they were all found dead.
Oh, Jesus, Ben, don't even whisper that into the universe's ear, because a week and a half from now, I'm going to see some damn stupid article from some ignorant fundamentalist saying, "Well, you know, that lake in Africa is the cause of the global warming. See, we told you man didn't do it."
They already say junk like that.
They don't need any help.
But everyone died. Everyone died.
Well, you can't breathe the stuff.
If we start pumping the CO2 into the deep, deep ocean at the rate at which we produce it, what's to say that this isn't going to happen where someday the Atlantic Ocean off New York City boils? And all of Manhattan and Queens and the Bronx and Newark die. because there's no oxygen left in it.
Well, then we will tell the rest of America the same thing that Appalachia has been told for the last 100 years, that coal keeps the damn lights on.
Put those people's lights out, I think.
Yeah, but, well...
But, you know,
it's a PR campaign.
So what we got to do is do something with the CO2 that's already there. The only rational thing to do is to break it down. There's also a process where you use an electric arc and moisture with CO2, and you get methane out. And you can burn that methane and do things with it. And that's carbon control because the carbon was already in the air to begin with.
Wow. Hey, Ben, I got to roll, brother.
You take care.
Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye.
Bye now. Okay, new title. Hardest working man in liberal talk, among the smartest men in liberal talk, without a doubt. Hey, Preston.
Hey, Bob.
You still there? Good.
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. We got a couple of minutes left.
Okay, I'll be brief. Listening to that discussion on science, and I was reading the latest issue of The New Scientist, and... The title story is something like a second Genesis, and they're writing about, you know, synthetic life forms that are picking up lab somewhere. And oh, did you hear that?
Yeah, I heard me. That's okay.
Okay. I'm on your chat room too. Always enjoy.
Yeah, I saw you there.
I just figured out how to do that, and I'm enjoying it. Also. Speaking of things that are hot and uranium and stuff like that, a couple issues ago in Yes Magazine, the editor, Sarah Van Gelder, interviewed George Shultz, who said that he's in favor of eliminating nuclear weapons. So, you know, I don't know if he's...
When you hear something like that, Preston, you think the sun's going to come up in the west. George Shultz. Well, you know, better late than never. No, welcome to the effort, George.
True. It was interesting because the question, Sarah asked him this question about, can the United States be secure without its nuclear stockpile? And he says that you're going to be more secure if there are no nuclear weapons in the world. Because if you achieve this goal, you won't be risking having nuclear weapons blow up in one of our cities.
And if everybody else has gotten rid of theirs and somebody's got a suit, one of those much ballyhooed suitcase nukes, whose reality I'm very suspicious, you're going to know where it came from. Because it's all, you know, it really is. And Ben could straighten me out if I'm wrong. These things really do have molecular signatures.
Interesting.
So it's traceable. Well,
yeah. So I thought that was something kind of hopeful to see even people among the elite are bringing up this issue. You know, there are so many people doing this hypocritical posturing about being concerned about our security, but they never talk about threats from nuclear weapons, including our own stockpiles. And again, the things we could do if instead of building more nuclear weapons, our new family of nuclear weapons, or militarizing space, or creating another nuclear-powered submarine, what we could do regarding solar and mass transit and healthcare and keeping libraries open and on and on and on. It would be amazing. It would be like something out of the Bible, heaven on earth.
Yeah, it's... And, you know, that's what it teaches, that heaven on earth is our responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. And, striving for it, at least striving for it, you know.
Right, at least make the effort.
Mm-hmm. What else? Did you notice Michelle Obama announced the White House edible garden will be made?
Yes, I'm really impressed by that. I mentioned the other night. Not only is there going to be a garden, apparently there are also going to be bees. And I've gotten to where I get, you know, just real misty eyed about bees anymore.
Me too. I was so happy to see, you know, this is an example of how a corporation can do good things. And I think Haagen-Dazs, I don't eat a lot of ice cream, but every now and again it hits the spot. And I've started buying Haagen-Dazs when I do strawberry because they have this fantastic campaign regarding the bees, like SaveTheBees.com or something like that.
Oh, neat. Haagen-Dazs?
Wonderful graphics. Haagen-Dazs ice cream, because they know how fundamental bees are to their business.
I'll have to forgive them their Guar gum and their locust bean gum and get some Haagen-Dazs.
Okay. I'll send a link to this bee campaign that they've got. I think actually Disney also did something good, and I can't stand Disney in a lot of ways, but there's an element within the Disney Corporation doing good things, like or maybe it was Pixar. They did that, the Bee movie. I don't know if you saw that by chance.
Yes, I did, with Jerry Seinfeld as the Bee.
Yes.
Yeah, we've seen it a million times around. It's just cute as heck.
Yeah, and I think has a good, a mixed political message. But on the whole, I liked it. I thought it was...
Just making people conscious of the fragility of the system, I think, is a good start. And frankly, if some right winger like Michael Medved watches it and pens some jeremiad against it, you know that it can't be entirely wrong. It's sort of like the purple polka dotted blue screaming hissy that they had about WALL-E.
Yeah, and you can see how some spokespeople for some industries hated that film WALL-E. This message about trash and consumerism issues. And, a message about people getting off the lazy boys every now and again and going against the machine.
But I'm noting this in the chat room as well. Basically, some of the Pixar people have taken over Disney, right? If I read that correctly. I saw somewhere the other day that the new sheriff in town said, we lost our focus on quality and good stories and we were just pumping out crap.
Yeah, I get the feeling that maybe HBO had kind of a changing of the guard, too, and not for the better. I mean, in the past, they just had a series and very closely together of good documentary films, kind of radical programming like 6 Feet Under, very gay-friendly, very hot-friendly, very introspective. And now I see... fewer documentaries, and I'm seeing, and their series are like Rome, which I don't think is the best contribution. It's kind of like a soap opera. And
I watched that. I'm fighting words. Back when I was off the air for a week and sick, I watched every last minute of Rome, and they played fast and loose with the history.
Yeah,
but it was a damn fun soap opera.
Yeah, and I see the entertainment value of it and stuff, but it just wasn't. It wasn't the sort of thing that it was kind of reactionary, actually. A lot of the messages of it, the normalization of it's the ugly part of human nature, I think, being kind of normalized or almost encouraged. You had a caller a couple of days ago about how we need to accept our dark side.
Yes, that was Albert.
Ourselves. Yeah. I totally agree with that. But so much of the media, that's what they really promote. I mean, they put it in our faces constantly. If you're to watch so much of the elite media, you'd think humans were just constantly deep, bloodthirsty. We do to the human species what's been done to, say, African Americans in the past. Caricatured, made to be ridiculed and degraded and feared. That's done to the human species, I think, in general, through much of the media.
Well, there's really two schools of thought there.
Okay.
There's the three. There's the we are fundamentally mean primates. Chimpanzees gone bad. And then what that middle ground that I put forward the other night, that we are chimpanzees gone sideways. That we're just kind of we don't mean to, but by virtue of our mistake prone nature, We're kind of screw ups. We're the planet's three stooges.
Or by virtue of our sideways culture, we've been kind of sideways.
And then there's the Anne Frank school that where she writes through it all, I still believe that the human beings are fundamentally good, and then they killed her.
Yeah, yeah. But she'd see those people as, you know, particular lost, you know, lost people.
Oh, I know, and that's why I've reiterated on a number of evenings lately that within about 300 to 400 years of each other, two human beings came up with the idea that you should love your enemy, and the state executed both of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you know, 2,000 years fast forward, there's Anne Frank doing the same thing, dead. Gandhi, dead. Martin Luther King, dead.
Yeah.
It doesn't, it's at least some empirical evidence for the malevolent side of things. But if anybody can be blamed, if we're going to engage in this level of introspection, one of the things, I'm guilty because I know that it's easy to get on the air for 3 nights and talk 3 hours a night and talk about what's wrong, because it's awfully hard to find what's right. You're very good at it. I'm not.
Yeah, and it can be tough. And even the good things we find sometimes, it seems like they're being overwhelmed by a tsunami of bad.
And that's one of the things, you know, when I get to go out on the road and I get to run around with all and have contact and real communication with all these really good people, it really charges my batteries when I come back, Preston. Because I'm coming back to a very bad place.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Or a conflict that's very bad. The place is magnificent. What they're doing to it is hell on earth, and the people doing it at the top level really are evil primates. The people that they're manipulating to actually get the work done are simply misguided and sideways.
Yep. You know, and they're doing it here in Colorado. I mean, I mentioned the natural gas wells are going up all over the place, and this huge network of, you know, miles and miles of service roads, these toxic, poisonous ponds that they create. Now, next on the drawing board is oil shale development, which takes huge.
And God, I thought we debunked that stupidity 25 years ago, Preston.
Yeah, the general population did. But again, there's that twisted, sideways element in our society, you know, following a very different agenda.
Right.
From their institutional context.
Yeah, the corporatists who said, it's all right. They've put us off of it for a while, but we'll come. We'll just remember. We'll file this away, and one of these days we'll come back.
Yeah.
And we'll do it whether they like it or not, because we'll tell them we have to.
Yeah. They destroyed Eden in Hawaii. I was listening to Stephen Kinzer being interviewed this morning, actually, and in his book Overthrow, he talked about the. I don't even like to say the U.S. overthrow of Hawaii because, you know, I think a lot of people were unaware of what was going on. It was the, you know, an element of U.S. society overthrew Hawaii.
Oh, the United States. Well, yes, there's that. And the United States was so blind to what we were doing at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century in the Philippines that when Mark Twain wrote about it, his editors and his advisors would not let him publish it.
Okay.
Because it was, and you know, that includes things like the war prayer. Because they said, you know, Sam, you are a beloved national the symbol now. People will hate you for this.
Mm-hmm.
And so, consequently, the war prayer wasn't published for 10 or 15 years or more after Clemens was dead. Because the national psyche could not be confronted with the fact of what Smedley Butler would later write about, the fact that, you know, that he went to Nicaragua and he was an enforcer. He wasn't I was sent there as a United States Marine, but I wound up being an enforcer for United Fruit.
Yep, that's right. That's right. And he criticized the Brown Brothers banking system or something like that, Standard Oil. He also mentioned them.
Yeah. You know, he was in hate. And that's the thing. He won his is he the only guy ever to win two Congressional Medals of Honor? And he didn't win them in World War I, which he was eligible for. He won them in, I think, the Philippines and Nicaragua, or Nicaragua and Haiti.
Yeah.
And he came around, and you know, his experience is there, not his experiences, you know, fighting the Hun, because they were practically non-existent. His experiences there were what caused him to sit back and write War is a Racket. You know, there's not a whole lot of book there. It's a very thin little thing. You can find it online, but I can't encourage people enough to read that thing. It may be the single most honest thing penned in English in the last 100 years.
You know what? Actually, this makes me think of as sort of another interpretation of that line about loving your enemy. That is Smedley Butler, who was out to hate and destroy his so-called enemy, came to love his enemy, or at least expose the violence for what it was. And he came back, and he seemed to be fighting, you know, those forces that had twisted him so badly. They didn't kill him. I'm sure plenty of people wanted to. He did die young, I think in his early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure he was marginalized and ridiculed and people blocking his work as well. But in some ways, the truth will out. And he's now featured in a documentary called The Corporation, which has been seen by millions of people.
Yes.
His books are doing quite well. There's a push to get him on a stamp. That would be fun to see. And you just mentioned his name. You just put it out there in the universe, and I'm sure, you know, your listeners are kind of...
Oh, he's a hero to me, and has been for a number of years.
Yep.
In a way, you remember Colonel Hackworth?
David Hackworth, yeah.
In a way, I think we wound up with a Colonel Hackworth because there was a Smedley Butler first.
True. I think a lot of people are standing on his shoulders. And I still
want to find time to go somewhere and do the library research to find out what he did what Butler did while he was in West Virginia working for a coal company.
That would be an interesting research.
I just
project.
Really want to know the answer to that, and it may be the only thing that isn't on the internet. But so far, I haven't found it. Hey, Preston, I do have to run along. We've run over a little bit, but I love our conversations, and I hope you have a great weekend. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Let me leave you with this.
Okay.
I found the website for that Haagen-Dazs campaign.
Oh.
And I think it's some of the most beautiful web graphics I've seen. The site is helpthehoneybees.com.
Go on there. When Preston says it's some of the most beautiful web graphics he's seen, I got to see it. Oh, yes, it is.
And definitely click on the next link, and it just gets better. I'm really enjoying it.
That's gorgeous. That is a nice animation. Okay. You've given me an excuse to get Haagen-Dazs.
Great.
You know, I'm surprised that they beat Ben and Jerry to this, but yeah.
Great. Well,
all right.
Nice weekend.
Take care, Preston.
Good night, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye now. From Colorado, our resident optimist and raiser of spirits, Preston. So that's the show for tonight. It's 9:10. I've run over by 10 minutes. I apologize, but those 10 minutes were free. So I wish you all a good weekend, and a reminder, it's not over on the horn on the weekend. Coming your way tomorrow at about 5:15 p.m., the Rick Smith Show, followed by at 7 p.m., Rick's Place with horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner, and then Night Sounds with Billy Shears, the one and only. A fresh Rick Smith Show comes your way on Sunday afternoon, and then at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Sunday night, live, fresh, real, all foxed up with John Fox, who is also our chief engineer, our chief musician, our web designer, and renaissance man upside down, because he's in Australia and everything. We're right side up. Ordering things. Peter Godbold is our IT professional. He has been fighting a stalwart war to get reasonable broadband back. I'm hoping one of these days when he does that we'll hear from Peter again and just see what's going on in Godbold world. Ben Burch, you already know, is the hardest working man in liberal talk. He saved liberal talk in 2002 with WhiteRoseSociety.org. WhiteRoseSociety.org. If you appreciate the horn, you appreciate the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. Lord, the work they have done has turned up the heat, and it's getting mighty, mighty hot under the heels of the people that threaten us all downstream. Heroic folks, Coal River Mountain Watch. Thank you to all of you who have contributed this month. You've gotten us closer to our monthly goal this month than we have been in months themselves, which means, well, it's thrilling. There. By the time we come back on the air Monday, there will be 2 days left in the month of March. It would be nice to actually get to $2,000 and sort of hang even for 1 month. Thanks to those who have gotten us so close, so very close. Your contributions and your commitment make this possible. Thanks to those who chat in the chat room, post on the forum, who listen, who podcast. You really do make it all worthwhile. And always, always, always. Gina. It's all for you.